Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn, inviting you to come down and see the all-new Lincoln MKX. We have them in stock and available for immediate delivery. Click on Demmer.com for details. Come see the all-new Lincoln MKX at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn.
Phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome everybody. Joining me in the WRIF studios here in Detroit, Michigan, Jalene Jordan, our on-air producer. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Peter.
How you doing?
Oh, you know, in spite of all the bad news out there, I'm doing all right.
That's good. That's good. Can I, what time is it? 11 o'clock. Can I tell a joke like this?
Sure.
I got to run it by you.
It's your show.
Yeah, I guess so. Hey, do you know why women don't like Republican men?
Why, Peter?
Because they lie to get in, and once they get in, they don't know what they're doing.
That's a pretty good one.
Okay.
Where'd you get that?
I don't, let me see. I can't remember. Probably the guys they play handball with.
Ah, okay.
That's the kind of jokes we tell.
Well, those are good jokes.
All right.
You can tell Republicans.
313-298-WRIF. Our friends at the Waking Up store, a Metro Detroit sweatshop free clothing store, is not actually a formal sponsor. But these folks are doing such good work, and I just want to give them a shout-out and say thanks to many of you that have gone by the Waking Up store in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile and DeQuinder in Warren. Yeah. All right. So, hi, Mike and Denise Kitchen. I should get out there as well. Well, in about an hour or so, it will be Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And, you know, Jillian, it's kind of hard to not do something that isn't done by everybody else. It's time for reflection and all that. And I guess it, you know, I don't know why I say it so cynically, because it is a good time to have points in our lives that we do reflect and we do think what our lives are about in a particular society, what the culture is all about, and think about what it was and how it was transformed. And of course, what U2 has that song, what's the name of it? April, you know, Shot Rings Out, April 10th. Yeah, it's a rock and roll song. Come on, you're a rock and roll teacher.
You know
so
that?
So am I.
I tell you, that's one of the things I'm worst at.
What,
at
you too?
It's no way when people say, what is that song? And then they speak the lyrics to me.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I just,
well,
I don't know.
Anyway, on the the U2 Live LP, one of the ones they've got a live album. And in fact, they got joined by B.B. King at one point.
Oh, yes.
But they sing the song. Why can't I?
Is it In the Name of Love?
In the Name of Love. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you. All
wow.
Right. Everybody can stop.
I've redeemed myself.
Yeah. Well, I haven't, but thank you. And so Bono says Martin Luther King, saint. And I'm thinking, you know, I don't think Martin Luther King Jr. would like that at all.
Well, he was a humble man.
Yeah, he was pretty humble.
Yeah. So maybe you're right.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, we've heard his oration so frequently over the years that sometimes it's easy to forget just how stunning it actually was when you think about, I mean, put him up against any politician, let alone the guy that is accidentally, maybe they, I guess they did it on purpose, occupying the White House.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, talk about that. Talk about Martin Luther King Jr. and what is embedded in, not only in the words of his speech, but the passion in which he spoke those words.
And he wasn't even going to give that speech, that final speech. He had a different one planned.
What, I Had a Dream?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, he had a different one planned. And then he just, I guess he got up there and that's what took over. And it's the one that we all know.
Well, you know, he first gave that speech, a variant of it, in 1963 as well, here in Detroit.
Oh.
There was this enormous civil rights march down Woodward Avenue with labor leaders like Walter Reuther and I don't know who else, maybe the mayor, and Martin Luther King Jr. And he gave that speech, I think, in Cobo Hall. Probably most of you rockers just think of Cobo Hall, Grand Funk Railroad, and Bob Seger.
The latest was the Disturbed show there.
They had the Disturbed show? Okay. Hey, by the way, if you'd like to call in, 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan with you. Well, Martin Luther King Day is here in the Detroit area, and I suspect around your place of the planet. Well, maybe not all over the world, but certainly here in the United States. There's all sorts of events, downtown Detroit, Central United Methodist Church, Woodward and Grand Circus Park, but there's also events going on in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan, in Livonia, put on by Livonia's Human Relations Commission, and People of Livonia Addressing Issues of Diversity, PLAD. I like that. It spells out PLAD.
Oh,
in Southfield,
okay.
Gathered Hope United Methodist Church on Northwestern Highway in West Bloomfield at West Bloomfield High School in Walled Lake. That's all I have. There may be other stuff as well. Walled Lake Northern High School, there's going to be activities as well there. And if you'd like to see this information, I'm sure it was a little hard to copy down. You think, oh, I'd like to go to that. And, you know, I've had more and more people, Jalene, recently say to me, man, all this stuff with this Bush racket, Bushco, is just going too far. Where can I get involved in things? How can I attend rallies? How can I have a public expression of my views? And I say, well, it's out there. And sometimes stuff is tough for people. Like a lot of people feel like uncomfortable in a public demonstration with a sign. I mean, you and I don't.
Well, you know, we don't. But you know what? You don't even have to have a sign. Most of the time when I'm there, I'm marching with all the people who have the signs. I've forgotten my sign or I haven't made one. It doesn't matter. It's the fact that you're there. And, you know, there are so many opportunities to go out and with other people stand together. So many, in fact, that if you really paid attention and found all of the resources, you could not make it to all of them probably because of your schedule or whatever.
Well, one of the things I told people, they say, how do I find out about these things? I say, well, go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com. And, I mean, we take being involved in protest demonstrations with signs for granted. But some people, I was starting to say, that they might find it initially difficult. Well, here, these are rallies, and these are very social. Officially approved. I mean, Martin Luther King's memory officially has really been domesticated, has really been toned down. Because the reason, in my estimation, that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, if you believe that, you know, single lone assassin of Martin Luther King, you probably believe that JFK. Yeah, or Bobby Kennedy. But Martin Luther King Jr. did two things that may have led to his death. The number one was becoming an anti-war spokesman. That's in 1967, 1968. And he gave a famous speech at Riverside Church in New York City. And, in fact, yeah, I do. I have it on my website, same one, peterwerby.com. He said, the chain reaction of evil, war is producing more wars. Think about Iraq and Iran. But he said, the chain reaction of evil, war is producing more wars, must be broken or we shall be plunged into the dark abyss of annihilation. So that added to the fact that he also became an advocate for organized labor. That's why he was in Memphis. Remember that? I mean, most people know that. They say that he'd gone down there to help these African-American sanitation workers who were on strike. And he was criticized considerably, like by Condoleezza Rice's father, who was
really?
Who was a Birmingham preacher who called Martin Luther King Jr. and the people that were fighting for civil rights ignorant Negroes.
Well, no wonder she turned out the way she did.
She was taking tennis lessons while her compatriots, young black kids, were getting hosed down and dogs sicked on them. She was, you know, perfecting her backhand. You know,
yes.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was possible to dislike her anymore.
Well,
you've made it possible, Peter.
These,
thank you.
Yeah, everybody in Bushco, they always can ratchet it up. And one other thing, by the way, about history, I and a bunch of my old pals are going to be involved in, what are they calling this now?
Oh,
but it's sort of a history of Wayne State University, of the social protests.
Oh.
So myself and Dan Aldridge and Abayomi Azikiwe, Charles Simmons, Marta Lagos, Elena Harada, General Baker, and me, Peter Werby, are going to be speaking on Wednesday and Thursday, the 17th and 18th of January. So coming right up. And I'm going to be speaking at 6 p.m. on Thursday, January 18th. It's going to be at the Wayne State University Student Center in room 261. And I'm going to be speaking about that old radical student group, Students for Democratic Society, SDS, which, by the way, has been resurrected. And now there are is a national SDS.
Wonderful.
And also the Fifth Estate newspaper, which still exists. You can go to fifthestate.org, having nothing to do with the Canadian television program, which stole the name from Detroit's Fifth Estate newspaper. All right, that all said, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743, and email calltalkyes@yahoo.com, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Did you get a chance, I didn't, to see George Bush on 60 Minutes tonight?
Well, first of all, I refused to watch him in a visual sense. So, no, I didn't, but I have read some of his spoken words, online.
Here, the headline in Yahoo News, Bush talks tough in case for troop boost. So here he goes again. Yeah. So who's opposed to this escalation? The American people, by about 80%, including what we saw in the November elections. Congress. In fact,
except for Lieberman.
Lieberman.
He's all excited about it.
Yeah. Why? I guess they have to keep him in as a Democrat, right? Or he votes with him. All right. What commie said this? This is a little game that we often play. What commie said this? Remember, this was on Wednesday that Bush announced this newest escalation. I mean, this has every memory of Vietnam. Something like that. Yeah. He said the president's Wednesday night speech was the most dangerous foreign policy blunder carried out since Vietnam. And we'll find out who it is, he called it a, quote, dangerously wrong-headed strategy that will drive America deeper into an unwinnable swamp at great cost.
Okay.
What commie said that?
I'm going to say Colin Powell.
Republican Senator Chuck Hagel. From Nebraska.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I knew it was a Republican.
Yeah, sure. Because there's the realization. In fact, maybe people could come up with an idea because, you know, I'm supposed to be the smart guy, the host of a talk show, is I haven't a clue what these maniacs are doing. I mean, there's some thought that they want to just keep this going long enough to dump it in the hands of the next president. But that's a long time from now.
Yeah, it sure is.
George W. Bush is going to be president until January 20th, 2009. Yeah. So so that could mean another couple thousand dead, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe more of Iraqi dead. Already 650,000 civilians. And everyone says this will do nothing to the equation. This is a non-strategy. Let's give it the best possible spin. and that this will win. This will be successful.
Or this will settle things down in Baghdad.
This will work, yeah. At the cost of what? How many American lives and how many Iraqi lives is George Bush willing to spend? Now, Cheney. Oh, I mean, I like George Bush compared to Dick Cheney. Here's what Cheney said. That he said, whatever it takes to win.
We don't care about Congress.
Yeah, I believe we will. If the United States doesn't have the stomach to finish the job in Iraq, we put at risk what we've done in all those other locations out there.
That's whatever, your mob voice.
Whatever the hell. Well, that don't sound at all like Cheney.
No, that was kind of like him, I guess.
Yeah. Now, here, this son of a bitch, Cheney, excuse me, get the kids away from the...
It's late.
Yeah, it's late. Here's a guy that supported the war in Vietnam, talking about that era, and he dodged the draft. Now, I'm all for that. You know, you Vietnam vets might kind of want to verbally beat up on me if you do it. 313-298-WRIF. I supported draft dodgers in Vietnam and their memory. These were men that knew this was another war based on lies that was this meat grinder that killed millions of people, mostly Iraqis, but to almost 60,000 Americans. And I can understand not supporting that war, hating Nixon, understanding why someone would, quote, dodge the draft. But here, somebody like Dick Cheney, far right-wing Republican always to the core, even when he was a young man, dodged the draft and urged other people on to fight it, exactly what he's doing today. Now, I'll tell you, if you want to object or support the president, you better be... you better be over 42, because the first thing I'm going to say to you is get your ass down to the recruitment station. They're taking people up to 42 now. Did you know that?
Yeah, well, I knew it was 40s, early 40s.
Yeah, in fact, they got a mother and daughter in there, 42-year-old mother,
right,
and a 41-year-old.
Wow.
Actually, a 42 mother, 41-year-old, or 21-year-old. Yeah, yeah. And so that's what I'm going to say. And why doesn't Bush urge those darling little twins of his to stop running their booties around
South America?
South America, yeah. And get in the Army. I mean, wouldn't that show sacrifice? I mean, Bush, wouldn't that make him take Cheney's advice? Does he have the stomach, as Cheney says, the godfather, to stomach the sacrifices necessary with no guarantee of winning? But the other thing that gets me here, Bush conceded that his decisions have led to more instability in Iraq. Oh, well, hey. So I saw something said, do you think anybody would hire this guy as a CEO? I mean, only in government, like Henry Kissinger, too. One catastrophic misadventure in foreign policy that winds up again in the deaths of millions. This is Kissinger, and who was advising Bush. And we have Bush... who admits now that his decisions have led to instability. He was being interviewed by Scott Pelley at Camp David Friday. President says the current sectarian violence in Iraq is a destabilizing factor. Do you think? That could lead to attacks here in America. Well, how the hell did it get unstable, destabled?
Yeah, well, it wasn't very stable to begin with, but there was, it wasn't the, you know, we've stirred up that hornet's nest.
Yeah, it was, you know, there was nothing happening. I mean, it wasn't anything like this.
Yeah, this is just unimaginable,
yeah.
Really.
He defended his decision to invade Iraq in the same way, saying Saddam was competing with Iran to get a nuclear weapon and make the region unstable. This is total crap. This man is an idiot or a lying idiot. Or an idiotic liar.
There's many ways you can say it.
Yeah. When pressed by Pelley, the 60 Minutes guy, Bush conceded that conditions in Iraq are much worse now. Pelley, but wasn't it your administration that created the instability in Iraq? Bush, I can't do a Bush. Our administration took care of a source of instability in Iraq. Whew. Envision a world in which Saddam Hussein was rushing for a nuclear weapon. This is total lies.
Yeah.
He had no nuclear program at all. 0, 9, 0.
Well, pretty much if he's speaking, lies are coming out.
That's how you can tell he's lying. His mouth is open,
yeah.
Right? He was a Pelley, it's much more unstable now. Mr. President, Bush, well, no question. Decisions have made things unstable. Who's the decider?
Yeah.
Who's the decider?
Who's in charge here?
Yeah, right. I think history is going to look back and see a lot of ways we could have done things better, says Bush. Do you think?
Is that that comma he was talking about?
Died for a comma. Boy, I don't even have that up. All right. Now, go to our favorite thing, connecting the dots. Hey, 313-298-WRIF. We'll get to your calls in just half a second. Now, I only call Bush president when I'm quoting. So this is from the Associated Press. President Bush on Saturday challenged lawmakers skeptical of his new Iraq plan to propose their own strategy for stopping the violence in Iraq. Bush said to pose everything while proposing nothing is irresponsible. We have a new strategy with a new mission. Our plan puts Iraqis in the lead. Huh? Mm. But in any event, here's this guy that admits he's screwed everything up, has taken a situation that really wasn't unstable. I mean, Iraq was not planning any attacks on anybody.
Didn't they have a plane made out of balsa wood or something like that?
No, that was one of the insane lies. Oh, yeah. No, they, at one point, people forget these crazy things. They said, I can't remember whether it was Bush or Condoleezza Rice or Cheney or somebody that said Iraq had ships, maybe Colin Powell, had ships going around the country, around the world, that had these drones that could be launched from there and could attack the heartland of America.
That's right.
Yeah.
That was just one of the many
insane
lies that led up to the invasion.
I mean, these people are totally mad.
Yeah.
And they have, and all of the Middle East could go up in flames. They're bringing another battle group into the area, a naval battle group. And I'm thinking, are they really going to attack Iran? A lot of people think it's a done deal. But what in the world could that do?
Ugh.
I mean, maybe,
no good, absolutely no good.
Well, you got to remember, these guys thrive on chaos. I mean, the 99% of the people in the world that inhabit the planet just want what? To have a nice, quiet, secure, peaceful life where they don't get screwed with by other people or other armies or what have you. These rulers, they thrive in situations of chaos. We've said 100 times that, maybe more, that that Bush was down the tubes on September 10th, 2001. The only way he has ever gained any popularity is through following the attack and then maintaining this level of fear, which people after a while didn't even buy. I mean, could he do something like purposely stir up the hornet's nest even more, hoping that an attack would come on the United States again?
I don't even like thinking about
that. No, neither do I. Well, my three predictions that gas prices would rise, I'm wrong on that.
I paid $1.99 last night.
You got screwed.
I did?
$1.89 at Citgo, dear.
Oh!
Well, you didn't go to Citgo.
It was at a Citgo, but it was yesterday. Was this today?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Okay, I understand. And what did I say? Cheney would resign.
Yes.
But I'd like to be wrong on that. I mean, keep him there because he's such an unpopular symbol. And I did predict that there would be a terrorist attack. So me and one of those religious nuts, Robertson or somebody.
Oh, Pat Robertson.
Did he say that? Was that him?
He's one of many, yeah. He's the one who makes the big predictions.
Well, I'd like to be wrong on all three.
Wouldn't that be good?
Yeah, that'd be good. I don't mind being wrong on stuff like that.
I just can't believe it hasn't happened yet, Peter, to be honest with you, since 9/11.
Right. I mean, maybe they're doing their job finally. They didn't do their job beforehand. I mean, Bush is the master of disaster. 9/11 being his first disaster. Cheney said of Democratic leaders, they have absolutely nothing to offer in its place. I mean, someone said to me, well, what's your solution? Well, what the hell? He screwed it up so badly. But didn't he have some people in there, like all his dad's friends that were trying to bail him out? I mean, they had some ideas. Condoleezza Rice says he's warned that the U.S. will take actions against countries destabilizing Iraq. Our friend David Rovix has
a
song.
She's really on fire, isn't she?
Yeah. What was that David Rovix song? Something about we have to bomb ourselves.
Oh, well, he has so many songs.
He does have a lot. Yeah. Everybody else is heading out. The Italians have left. The Slovaks are about to. Britain wants to start getting out. They're taking out 2,200 troops.
Even Britain? Are you serious?
Yeah, the Danes
Bush's
and the South.
Puppets?
Yeah. Poodle.
Oh, the poodle.
The poodle's leaving.
Right.
Let's see. Britain's chief ally is getting out. Let's see here. In Romania, however, continued involvement has touched off a bitter squabble between Prime Minister Calin Popescu and Popescu Terencino, boy, I'm missing that one, who wants the 860 troops home, and staunchly pro-U.S. President Trion you know, if I thought about this, I could... This is a...
Get some pronouncers?
No, it's a romance language. Basescu, it probably is. Yeah, Basescu, the president, who refuses to cut and run. I mean, this is the Associated Press writer saying the guy wants to take your troops out of this meat grinder that he's cutting and running.
So it'll be us and, Guam. That'll be it.
No, that's our... Well, that's it. They're doing all this recruiting, like, in Guam.
They really are.
Yeah, they really are. All right, let's see if we can get some... Oh, wants to talk about... Let me see. Get the whole thing here. That doesn't work. I want to talk. Well, okay. We'll see what this is all about. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan with you on WRIF. And hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, what's going on?
Just doing the broadcast.
Yeah, about Bush. I'm 16 right now, and the war is really scaring me. Like, about the draft and the, like, because I'm going to be age in a couple of years.
Yeah.
And it just scares the bejesus out of me. And.
Well, I'll tell you, Drew, I don't think they're going to be putting in a draft. We said that last week. I mean, I don't know where the hell they're going to get all these new troops from, but anybody that tried to bring about a selective service again, a draft, it would doom themselves to a political defeat. So yeah, I don't think you have to worry about it.
Yeah, well, Bush is getting pretty desperate.
Like, yeah.
His dad was smart. I mean, not that smart, but his dad knew that when to come out, like to get out of Desert Storm, he knew not to take out Saddam, because if you take out Saddam, everything's going to go to hell, like what's happening right now.
Well, you got to remember, of course, is that all during the 1980s, Saddam Hussein was the ally of the United States, courtesy of Ronald Reagan and Donald Rumsfeld and George H.W. Bush. And he essentially became our ally again following the first Gulf War, when then-President Bush, 41, isn't that his number?
Yes.
Yeah, but then 41, knew that if he toppled Saddam, the whole place would go to hell. But the royal advisors, Rumsfeld and Cheney and all that, they thought they could do what Poppy couldn't, but they were wrong. Everything that Poppy said turned out, in fact, to be the case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have another question.
Sure.
I'm taking a broadcasting class at my school.
Okay.
And I want to know some any words of wisdom, what it takes to get on the radio.
Probably damn fool luck.
Huh? Passion.
Okay. Oh.
Passion matters.
Yeah.
I think.
It does. I mean,
I think just get in there and do it. Take any chance, opportunity you can, right, Peter?
Yeah. It's hard getting on the air. It's very hard getting on the air. But there's a lot of jobs in radio. Those are, though, like 8-hour jobs, right? You got to come in here and do, you know, like management and music direction. And
oh, right. Yeah.
Sales and all that. I mean, overall, in radio, the people that make the most on average are the salespeople.
Yeah, and the morning shows.
Yeah. Well, but if you think about the morning shows in small markets, they're not making too much.
I was on one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where?
In Des Moines, Iowa.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Oh, by the way, remember a little earlier I was quoting Senator Chuck Hagel denouncing Bush's escalation?
Yeah.
It was from the Sioux City Journal.
Oh, hey.
There in Iowa. Well, and in a lot of ways, in all of the entertainment industry today, Drew, it just has to do, I hate to say it, but with luck. I mean, think about the bands that get played on Motor City Riffs. I don't know if you hear that program.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes, I was listening to it, and then you guys came on. I was driving around.
Doesn't it have great music on it?
Yeah.
So why aren't...
I'm really surprised about...
Well, why isn't every one of those bands, for instance...
Signed to a major label?
Yeah, and, as big as the ones that have made it. I have no idea. I have no idea.
That really is a lot of luck.
Yeah, but actually, in a way, Jalene was right. You should do all of this with passion and understanding that...
Well, you probably have to start in a smaller market. And
that's for sure.
That's great. That is where you learn. And so just do everything you can. Don't let anything stop you. Have a positive attitude.
Thank you, Drew. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Here is John and Warren. John, it's Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for calling.
I was just wondering, Pete. I was first a Republican.
Yeah.
You know, I actually, you know, voted for Bush and stuff. But I look back now, and I'm thinking to myself, what the hell am I doing?
WTF.
This guy is sending, you know, our people over there, and they're getting slaughtered, actually. You know what I'm saying? 3,000 dead already. And, you know, he's sending another 20,000 more people over there.
It's not even clear to me where they're going to get them. Although, you know, they're doing this thing now where they're going to be able to keep sending these troops there endlessly.
I mean,
I know. Yeah. Already some of them have had 2 and 3 tours. That's amazing.
I mean, these are our sons and daughters, you know.
Sure.
And it's ridiculous what this guy is doing, you know. I voted for him, but I regret every minute of it now.
Did you vote for him? Was it financial, or what were your reasons?
Well, at first, yeah. The unemployment rate and everything.
Uh-huh. Okay. Here in Michigan.
Do something for the economy.
Well.
And it's not worth it. It's not worth the people and the lives that we're losing.
Well, I think that's important, John, that we put ethical concerns in what's happening to our neighbors before financial concerns, but even financial concerns that the average working man, middle-class person, working woman has gotten screwed big time. In fact, I think I will talk about that after our break. But thank you, John. I appreciate it. Let's go to another John. 313-298-WRIF. Here's John in Ann Arbor. John, hi. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
Hey, Jalene, I'm still paying $2-something here in Ann Arbor, so that's not that bad.
Oh, good. I don't feel so bad. Thank you, John.
Yeah. Peter, when I was attending school at Ferris State University, go Bulldogs, I had this civil rights class. We had a text called To Redeem a Nation, and it was collective essays and speeches and whatnot. And one of them in there was an interview, Martin Luther King interview.
Uh-huh.
And they were asking him about the nonviolent movement, especially in the face of violence. And this kind of complements, I think, your show, but also what you opened with. And he explained that he had to maintain the nonviolent movement because it's not, the means don't always justify the ends, but they have to be as pure as the ends. To receive, you know, to get equality with violence isn't going to happen because you're just going to have some kind of backlash. So
well, it's also,
I'll throw that out there.
Well, yeah, I think that's important. And there's also a tactical question. I mean, when you heard during the 1960s, people like Malcolm X, who also gave extraordinarily stirring speeches and was an orator whose speeches, I think, rivaled Martin Luther King, when he was talking about, essentially about self-defense, and the Black Panthers. Think about them, how they just got annihilated. So tactically, it's nonsense. You don't want to take on the political state in the manner that was going to get everybody killed. But even more so is what you're indicating. It's an ethical commitment. I don't know what you do here. In fact, I often talk with my Tai Chi teacher, who is a Buddhist or influenced by Buddhist philosophy and committed to nonviolence. And I said, well, what do you do when you meet unrelenting aggression? And it's a pretty complex question because I don't know. I mean, you're going to, like, say Gandhi in India, even though they were attacked physically by the British, it wasn't like they were rounding all the Indians up and putting them in concentration camps. And one would have liked to have thought that it would have been possible for the Jews of Europe and the Gypsies of Europe and the Slavs and the other people that were annihilated by the Nazis, if they would have been able to mobilize a greater resistance. And it wasn't that they didn't, because they, they'd be like all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this incredible military force comes into your neighborhood and starts rounding everybody up. It's a little hard right off the bat to all of a sudden become an armed resistance. I don't know. I think I'm just, I don't know what I'm doing. All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're doing great.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you. We'll be right back.
This is WRIF.com.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Joined by Jalene Jordan. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Robert in Port Huron says, hi, Peter and Jalene. My former employer moved to Port Huron from Rochester as a means of busting up the union down in Rochester. I vowed to bring the union to the shop in Port Huron and was fired over it. Do you believe that this is more a product of the corporate-friendly Bush regime, or is it a sad but true sign of the times? Well, both, and the fact that ever since people started organizing in the 1840s to try to get a better deal out of working, that they've been met with resistance of everything up to including troops slaughtering people or the police shooting down. As I've said so many times in talking about this, the police and National Guard in Pinkerton's 1930s killed 300 people organizing for unionization throughout the country in that decade.
So, and that's still going on in South America with the Coca-Cola Corporation.
Yeah.
The folks who try to organize down there are being shot and killed.
And,
to this day.
And Coke is the drink
of
the
death squads.
Yeah, because Coca-Cola Company was sitting still while organizers have been murdered by these death squads that have been trying to stop unionization of those plants down there. Mike and Denise Kitchen, the proprietors of Waking Up, say hi back. Remember we said hello to them?
Good, we did.
Yeah, we did. We said hello to them. And what is this all about?
Where are people emailing you, Peter?
At calltalkyes at yahoo.com. You know, this guy writes such weird-ass b-hole. I wrote him back.
Is he a comedian?
Well, let me see if I can find this. He'll love it, but I'll write it on. Yeah, I don't know if I can find it. This is what he wrote last time. Hey, corporation man. This is to me.
What?
War for oil, eh? I hear this mantra on a regular basis, but nobody ever considers that this is the Fall Guy slogan that the lizards provide the people with to hide a more sinister plan. Namely, a one-world system, cashless, borderless, faceless as a turd.
Wow.
Why would they do this? So that we all live by the same rules and drink from the same trough. Oh, brother, where art thou? Brother, can you spare a microchip? This sounds all cozy until we consider the majority of humans are living in subhuman conditions while we jet off to political rallies in Cuba and South America.
Ooh, slam, slam.
Talking about me. Do you think there will be compassion at the local level when there's always been malice in the central heart of any government ever born on this briny, bald planet? They are duping us by making us believe that there is a conspiracy. The conspiracy is that there is no conspiracy, but a set plan that they toss out there before us like dog biscuits, and we sniff and eat it up, but never taste the marrow of their trickery.
Ooh, this guy.
Their bag of tricks. Are you going to bite or beg, Peter, when they come for you?
He's good with words.
Yeah, but I don't know whether to deny or defend.
I don't either. Hey, you know, at least when you go to Cuba and Venezuela, you're not going to go to, like, the Sandals Couples Resort or something like that. I mean, you're going down there to learn.
Yeah, I was on the beach, though.
Come on, but you still learn.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I heard they had a lot of rum down there,
too. Oh, yeah, they did have some rum.
Didn't they have rum for breakfast?
I had rum for breakfast in Cuba, yeah.
Wow.
Mojitos, the great drink. Thanks for showing me this in the Detroit Free Press today. There is a cartoon by Jim Borgman from the Cincinnati Inquirer. They show the White House with Bush looking out and thousands of people out there with signs, no escalation, bring them home, 3,000 is enough. And an aide is saying to Bush, it's the counter surge, sir.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, and that it will be true. And, in fact, there is going to be one of those enormous marches on Washington Saturday, January 27th. I'm actually reading a book called Marching on Washington and the history of these marches on Washington.
Ooh.
That only began in 1894.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I would love to read that book.
Yeah. How many have you been? You've been to a number of them.
Oh, yeah. I think I've been to some anti-war marches. There are like three or four.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been to two of the big March for Women's Lives there.
Good.
Yeah.
Well,
You got me. You got me started. You got, right. gave me the fever.
So you're not going on January 27th, huh?
No.
You got to work.
I'm working all weekend here at WRIF.
I don't know. I'm going to jet off there. Everyone else is taking buses.
You are flying?
Well, if I go.
Okay.
If I go. Because I shouldn't tell people this. Now they'll get the only seats left, about $120 or something like that. That's not bad.
That's not bad at all.
I mean, $60 on
a
bus.
Is this the Southwest Airlines one? There's a they have one into Baltimore that's like $49 each way.
I'm there.
Really? You should check it out.
Okay.
And you know the thing with the bus, who is that? United for Peace? There's a peace organization.
Well, here in Detroit, it's being organized by Peace Action Michigan.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think often, like, they leave Saturday morning on the bus, and they I could actually leave after my air shift at 6 a.m.
No, they leave Friday.
Friday night?
Friday night. I used to do that.
Yeah.
And it was good. And I don't know. I'll tell you.
It's worth it.
There are a lot of people that are taking these buses. In fact, one of the people that's organizing the bus ride, Sigrid, a good friend of mine. Hi, Sigrid.
Hi,
Peace.
Sigrid.
She's in her 70s, I believe, maybe 60.
Oh, I've met her at one of the rallies.
60s or 70s, right?
I really don't know. I'm not good at the age
thing. That's, we don't want to go there. All right.
She's wonderful.
Anyways, you would, anyway, I've been corrected, not ways. So the ride, I don't know, I can't do it anymore. You leave Friday night about 6 o'clock. You get into Washington about 5 a.m., and then you just have to hang out on the buses. Then you march all day, and then you get back on the buses, and they bring you back to where you started about 5 or 6 a.m. Now, when I was a little younger, it was great. I mean, it is great traveling with all those people. And, you know, here, I'm actually going to go by myself. I'm actually going to fly there by myself. So, and the reason I have to be back by Sunday.
So, yes.
You know, I could do that. Hey, Sigrid, maybe I'll go with you.
I was thinking, yeah, you could be.
Oh, man.
Well, just take a little sack lunch.
All right. If you've never been on a march and you want to go, this is the one. If not now, when? What are you waiting for? It is an incredible experience to be in a city like Washington with hundreds of thousands of people.
It really is. It is the biggest rush of my life, and I've done a lot of things in my life.
Let's continue on. I'm going to march with U.S. labor against the war, which is all unions.
Yeah, and that's the other cool thing. You can march with... You march by yourself. You can join any group while you're there. It really is a wonderful event.
All right. You can call the Peace Action Michigan office at 248-548-3920. 548-3920. You go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com.
You can always go there and have patience when you go there.
Why?
Because there's a lot of information.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so much stuff there is, like, hidden. I the other day I went, oh, I didn't know that was there. Tomorrow, Monday, Martin Luther King Day, there is going to be a petition by active duty GIs to the Congress calling for withdrawal from Iraq and the end to the U.S. military occupation.
No kidding. Where is this out of?
Well, this is from a website called Appeal for Redress. Appeal for Redress. And it comes from the First Amendment of the Constitution, which says it's within, well, why guess when it's right here? I always carry my Constitution with me. The right of the people peacefully to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances cannot be abridged by the government. And there is nothing illegal about an active duty soldier petitioning the Congress.
Well, there must not be because, well, and also speaking out, I heard an interview last week of, I don't know what this guy's rank was, but he was calling from Baghdad.
Really?
And he was really nervous, and he was whispering because all of his people were around him. And he has a website. It might be this one.
No. This is very up and up. This is put together by Iraq Veterans Against the War, which is a group, IVAW. And I think it's IVAW.org, Veterans for Peace, and Military Families Speak Out. And it's a very simple, if you're an active duty military person and want to sign this, there's already 1,029 signatures on it. And they say, as a patriotic American proud to serve the nation in uniform, I respectfully urge my political leaders in Congress to support the prompt withdrawal of all American military forces and bases from Iraq. Staying in Iraq will not work and is not worth the price. It's time for U.S. troops to come home.
And these are men and women who have been there.
Yeah.
You know, because one of the criticisms I think that, we often get is, well, you haven't been there. You don't, these people, you know, you have no idea what's going on over here. How can you speak for us? Well, here you go.
Yeah. Anyways, it's pretty easy. You can, sometimes you can't see the forest for the trees, and sometimes you can't see the trees for the forest.
True.
There you go. 313-298-WRIF. So consider going to this march Saturday, January 27th in Washington, D.C. Let's see here. We'll go back to our phones. And, oh, man. All right. Let's do this. Because the guy that wanted to talk about, he was considering joining the armed services.
Yeah.
He dropped off.
Okay.
Call back.
Sure. Yeah.
313-298-WRIF. Here's James in Kenosha, Wisconsin. James, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hi, Jolene. I was with you there until you did that forest and trees thing, and now I'm all confused.
I guess I confused myself.
Also, Jolene, maybe we heard the same interview. That guy, he was nervous and about the phone call because he's active duty and was calling from Baghdad.
Yeah.
And so, he's standing there in uniform, probably on base, trying to make this phone call to do this interview. Anyways, I was calling a billion things, but I work for a college where we've been sponsoring a Martin Luther King commemoration celebration for the past 13, and this will be the 13th year. And so I have been working, and because of my job, I've been working with a lot of source material, including the Riverside speech. And the guy called a little
bit. That's the anti-war speech I mentioned, yeah.
Right, which gave a very similar speech at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta the same year. But the guy who called in, and I didn't really quite catch the point he was making about King's anti-violence stance or non-violence stance.
Mm-hmm.
That is one of the issues he brings up in this speech in terms of, in fact, his third reason for speaking out against the war was that, for the last three summers he'd been, counseling young, angry black men in the ghetto and telling them that Molotov cocktails and rifles are not the answer to solve their problems. And they said, yeah, but what about Vietnam? Isn't the nation solving its problem with paraphrasing, massive doses of violence solve the problem? He goes, he knew right then that he could never speak against violence used by the oppressed in the ghettos without first speaking clearly, and now, quote, to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. And you listen to this speech, and my first thought is like, no wonder they killed him.
Yeah.
And by the way,
Jane,
powerful.
Yeah, it is extraordinarily powerful, and I think I mentioned earlier that the text of it is on my website, or it's on a million other places. But
yeah, I linked off your website.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good. And there's also a video of the speech there. So you can hear the power of him. And, of course, the men create let me get gender correct here. People create the times, but times also create the people. And the fact that here was a man right there with the right message at the right time, and the times brought out the absolute best, and it was him.
Well, the amazing thing is that we're in the same time, and there's parallels beyond the war. As I was talking to whoever was the screener, a big one is when you look at, and you mentioned how the Black Panther movement was absolutely decimated through by with COINTELPRO and dirty tricks and surveillance and infiltration by the FBI. Well, hello, Patriot Act and warrantless wiretapping.
Well, a little bit more. Now, Bush says he can open our mail, and Cheney says that they can look at our credit records as well. But, hey, they're all, James, don't get nervous.
Cause I'm not nervous.
It's only terrorists that
I'm
are looking
nervous.
At.
I'm just, I'm angry. Like, yeah. Part of our deal tomorrow will be the Republican representative to Congress from our district will be there because it's a politically expedient thing to do, of course. And I'm not saying that the man isn't sincere in his admiration for Dr. King, but he's in a position to actually follow through on the message rather than just pay lip service to it. And he's going to get up there. Well, I'm in a position where I'm actually putting together an audio excerpt thing of the Riverside speech in order to do a bit of subversion. tomorrow because...
Don't give them hell.
One of the first things King says in that speech is, there comes times when silence is betrayal. And that's where I'm feeling right now.
Sure.
And I'll fly out to Washington if you're looking for a partner.
Well, email me. I have this feeling we'll be rattling around by myself. Although, like I say, this U.S. labor against war is going to be there. But it'd be good to meet somebody that I knew. Thank you, James.
Thank you, Peter.
Appreciate it. Yeah, my favorite quote, they used to say, give him hell, Harry Truman.
Yeah.
And he said, I don't give him hell. I just tell the truth and they think it's hell. Talking about the Republicans. Here, this from Yahoo News the other day. Actually, today. Vice President Dick Cheney said Sunday the Pentagon and CIA are not violating people's rights by examining the banking and credit records of hundreds of Americans and others suspected of terrorism or espionage in the United States. He says the Defense Department gets involved because we've got hundreds of bases inside the United States that are potential terrorist targets. Now, the problem with all of this is unwarranted wiretapping. What was the other thing you just mentioned?
The banking and the mail is that
we know that government is abusive. Its very nature is tyrannical. And it's only in a few select circumstances since the state arose as an institution 8,000 years ago that the people have been able to restrain its worst oppressive and repressive and dictatorial nature. And that's why we have this Constitution. And when you look through it, I mean, it's like these guys out of nowhere that did pop. There was nothing like little somethings before that, but nothing really. They just knew what government was all about, and they wanted to restrain government. And here is Bushco, this racket for the rich. And they're not even satisfied with that. They also want to rip away the protections that people have against government. And you can say, well, hey, I don't care if they look at my banking records or they open my mail or anything like that. And you say, they're only do it to terrorists. Well, you know what? How do we know? That's the whole reason why the search and seizure, the Fourth Amendment, that you have to go before a magistrate. And it's so easy. Just like they don't need the wireless wiretapping, the warrantless wiretapping, rather, that they could get warrants for this in a second. In a second. And if it was an emergency, they could go ahead and then, within, something like 2 or 3 days, they can go get a warrant after that. They want the power. They want to destroy constitutional government. These people.
What happened to small government?
Oh, these guys. Don't get me started. No, I'm supposed to do this. I'm supposed to get started.
Yeah.
Let's see. Here's Scott and Kimball. Scott, where's Kimball?
Kimball, yeah. Kimball's about 15 miles southwest of Fort Huron.
Yeah, okay. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I just wanted to talk about them troop numbers out there.
Sure.
Got a good friend of mine. He's in the service right now. He's stationed down there in Fort Riley, Kansas. He did some time over there in a box about a year and a half ago. And him and I had a nice conversation the other day, and he informed me he was going to reenlist.
Huh.
And I like I'm sure many other proud Americans back there, stood beside him and supported him, and I told him that I'll be there for him no matter what. Him and I talking about it, and he said that I asked him. I said, is there a specific reason? And he said, no, when I was over there in the box, he said someone had to come and replace me.
Wait, what does it mean, over there in the box? I mean, that's what they call a rack?
Sandbox, yeah.
Oh, the sandbox, yeah.
Yeah, sandbox.
Oh, cute.
So he said, somebody had to come over here to the box to replace me, so, I want to stick around to replace somebody else.
Well, a lot of those guys, from what I've read, their statements is they have this intense loyalty to their unit. And in fact, some guys have been wounded and they want to go, and some even had lost limbs, and they want to go back in non-combat positions. I mean, so intense is the internal loyalty. And that's what that's the best thing that an armed service can create. But I'll tell you, they also stand the risk of all of them saying no at some point, because the army in Vietnam was close to mass mutinies. I don't think we have anything like that now, unless maybe this petition by active duty soldiers is the you know, the tip of the iceberg of it all. But mostly you still get, from at least from what I see, is that people in the military, although you know, there's some polls saying that they're pretty dissatisfied with what's going on, they say, well, you know, I got a job to do and what have you. But it's hard for me to see how people are being sent back in there time after time without any progress, things getting worse, more deaths, more money spent. I don't know. All right, I got to take a break. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. I got some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. We will be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour. And at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, we're going to be doing a couple of interviews. Jalene Jordan is with me. And, of course, she, being my producer, remembers who they are, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's that one guy.
You remember, huh?
It's that one guy.
Oh, it's my old pal, Dan Georgiakis, talking about growing up Greek in Detroit. Growing up Greek in Motor City.
Oh, but I think that'll be really interesting.
Yeah, I love Dan. And yeah. Well, you know, that's what I start the interview with, saying most people, when they think of Greeks in Detroit, think of Opa.
Flaming cheese. It's a lot deeper than that.
It is. And also,
in fact, one of my very best friends is in town. She owns the New Way Bar over there in Ferndale.
Yeah, sure.
Her family, as Greek as they come, and she may be listening. Hey, Tina, how you doing?
Yeah. I'll think of the other interview. Why can't I think of these things? Oh, I know where it's on my, what the hell happened to my website? Didn't I have it right up there? Okay. Anyway, no matter. I wanted to read this email. Here it says, Peter, I'm 31 and been listening for 10 years. I want to go with you to the Washington March on January 27th. I don't like the sound of the bus trip. God, Sigrid's going to kill me. She's already organized one whole bus.
Good for her.
So they're putting on a second bus. Go on the bus. Go on the bus. If you're 31, go on the bus.
Yeah, definitely. It's the whole experience.
Split a motel, whatever. Hell, I'll go with James from Kenosha.
Casey, nice.
Best show with Jalene on Night Call so far. Actually, you have her name, just like I have to spell my last name, W-E-R-B-E. So you can find out all these things. The Martin Luther King Day schedule for four or five different places around town. All the information about the March on Washington on January 27th. It's Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And it's Jalene, J-U-L-I-N-E. Jordan. Oh, yeah.
I mean, right.
Ooh, man. Should I keep doing this?
You know, I do have another last name. Maybe that's why you got confused.
No.
You know, I'm married.
No, I didn't get confused.
Okay.
It just froze.
All right.
Yeah.
But no one knows that other last
name. Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Your first name, though, was a last name.
That's right,
right. Of a friend of your mother's.
That's right. Her name was Kay Jalene. That was her last name.
Well, good it wasn't like Magorowitz or something. Magorowitz,
Jordan.
Yeah. Hmm. All right. So all this stuff is going on. Take part in. Because, you know, I think, too, every once in a while, you ever had this experience at a demonstration, Jalene? People come up to you, and they have these big smiles on their faces, and they look at us, and they say, I think it is so wonderful what you people are doing.
Oh, yes.
And I'm going, hello?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you and I were at a march in Royal Oak.
Yeah.
This summer, and someone came up to us. It was when the cops were harassing all of us.
Right.
Remember that?
No, don't tell people that. That's what they get nervous about. Yeah, they don't harass you. They weren't doing well.
They said we crossed the street wrong and all this.
Yeah, they were giving the organizers a hard time.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so this woman and her baby came up, and she said, oh, this is just keep it up, thumbs up.
Yeah.
And I wanted to say, come on and join us.
Right.
Really.
Because direct involvement in it is extraordinary. And most of the important people in my life, in my adult life, have been through this movement for peace and social justice. And it ain't all grim. And it's, someone said to me, don't you ever have any fun? I've had people in the movement accuse me of having too much fun. They're the grim people. There's some grim people in it.
True. Yeah. Well, it's quite gratifying, really. You feel like you're not just sitting back reading the bad news and not doing anything about it. And whether we are changing the world or not, I do believe every time we're out there, we are in some way.
Well, yeah, and also, I mean, I feel it's an ethical imperative. Sometimes people will say, do you think this does any good? And I said, I have no idea. Howard Zinn says that generally these movements throughout American history have lost every battle but won every war, when you think about the reforms that have been made.
You know, speaking of Howard Zinn, A People's History of the United States, I'm watching The Sopranos, all of the episodes, because the last season's coming up in April.
Don't tell me they mention Howard Zinn in it.
Tony Soprano's kid, who's this high school kid who's kind of a thug of his own and a troublemaker, well, he was reading A People's History of the United States on the episode that I watched tonight, and it was all about Columbus Day, and the American Indians were coming, and they were protesting Columbus Day, and Tony and his people, you know, his boys didn't want this protest to happen, and Tony Soprano's kid was reading the whole part about how Columbus came over and decimated the Arawak Indians. It was wonderful. I almost cried.
Yeah. HowardZinn.org, Z-I-N-N.org. And there's a, I just saw, in fact, you'd seen it before, though.
Can you explain who he is for those who don't
historian.
Know? Historian. Okay. There
you go. I had a producer once that I was going to have Howard Zinn on, and I said, he's a historian. And he said to me, what's an historian?
Oh, my.
And I said, okay, I got to get another producer.
And you know what else?
Right.
Howard Zinn was instrumental in the civil rights movement.
Yeah, he was big.
So
the 60s.
He'll be out there tomorrow.
So he, I think, is almost 80. He was a World War II bombardier.
Yes,
and
he
has some incredible experiences. But there is a documentary about Howard Zinn called You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. Oh, which I loved.
It was real good, yeah.
All right, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Bill in Chesterfield. Bill, hi, it's Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. You're on the air.
Hi. Two things. I've called several times, and you always cut me off before I can rebuttal anything you say.
So, well, get ready for it again.
Yep, you always cut me off. So yeah. Here it goes.
Yeah, go ahead.
I support your whatever you want to say. You have the right to say. You have the right to march. You know, I agree with that.
And well, thank you.
Sometimes I agree with you, sometimes I don't. But one thing I never see is you want troops withdrawn. What do we do because there's still terrorists there? What's the solution to that?
Well, wait a minute. There's terrorists there. The only reason that, I mean, most of, 95% of the people there that are fighting the United States troops, whether they're the Sunni insurgents or the al-Sadr army, the Mahdi army, any of those Shiite groups, is because we're there in their country and we're the occupying force. Now, about 5% of the people fighting the United States are jihadists that have been drawn there from around the world to fight Americans because of the invasion of a Muslim land. So Bush created the situation in the first place and made it be essentially a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Did he create 9/11?
What does that have to do with Iraq?
Did he create 9/11?
Well, a lot of people say, yeah, Bill, and
Not a lot of people on Ed. Do you believe that 9/11 happened to Bush? Bush said, yeah, we're going to let it happen.
I don't know.
States government, perhaps.
Yeah, I don't think they knew that. And a lot of people, I'll answer your question directly. But a lot of people think that Bush was directly responsible for 9/11. And you can go to my website, I've said it enough times, and go to the 911 section, and you can see a lot of that. But what do I think? I think that Bush knew, as did the rest of the government, that something was going to happen somewhere at some time during his administration, because it had already happened during the Clinton administration. And I think that they had two plans. One was to invade Afghanistan and occupy it, and the other was to invade Iraq and occupy it, both for oil. And you see that coming true, particularly in Iraq, with what they're planning now to grab Iraqi oil. I mean, the United States, under these oil maniacs, Bush and Cheney and the rest of them, think that the only way the United States can be secure is that if we directly control the oil in the Middle East, that we have these vassal nations that are beholden to us, like Saudi Arabia and Jordan and Egypt, and you know, that we give billions and billions and billions of your money and my money to, and that we have these forward bases, and if it means that hundreds of thousands of people have to die, including thousands of Americans, well, that's all worth it, because that's what they call our interests in the Middle East. Well, it ain't our interests. It's George Bush's interest. It's ExxonMobil's interest, and that's who they want us to die and pay for.
So what do we do about the terrorists that are still out there?
Well, I'll tell you what. What do you mean, all over the world?
No, the ones that want us dead. The ones that say, that use the prison, that say, if you kill an American, you will go to heaven.
Oh, well, we have to, what do we do, I mean, what does England do against IRA terrorists? What do the people in Sri Lanka do against the Tamil Tigers? What do the Spanish do against the Basque terrorists, and on and on and on. People feel that they can solve their grievances, that they have righteous grievances that allow them to attack civilians because of whatever their particular cause is. I mean, Bush is, and people like that have a same scheme. I mean, we can kill hundreds of thousands of Iraqis because of, you know, fill in the blanks. Well, everybody's got an excuse for killing women and children. Bush does, the IRA does, the Muslim jihadists do. This is nothing new. There's not that many jihadists in the world. And to the extent that we're making enemies faster than we can kill them, it isn't exactly a good strategy. One of the things we could do would be to get the hell out of the Middle East in general, and stop mucking in the affairs of this region that we don't have any reason to continue in. In fact, the only reason we did was to pick up where these colonial nations did from the 19th century to begin with, Italy and France and Britain, countries like that. We're bringing this all on ourselves. We have to get off of oil. We have to disengage from these attacks on these nations across the world. Yeah. And we have to defend ourselves by making security, in the meantime, making sure security is such that we do not have other attacks like Bush allowed in 2001.
do you think that people over here saying we need to withdraw and that this is bad and this is not good is encouraging more terrorists to recruit because they say that, well, half of America doesn't even support this?
Well, hey, you're talking about 80% of America doesn't support it. Nobody supports that anymore except, I forgot, Bill. I said, I take it that you're under 42. Get your butt down to the recruiting statement on Tuesday, and you can fill in one of those slots.
Whoa.
Yes. Now, wait a minute now. You want other people to die for what you think is an important cause. It's not very ethically sound, is it?
That is not the point. I'm not saying because I'm not recruiting that. I'm not saying that just because I'm not recruiting, it does not mean that this isn't a good or a bad thing. But whatever. Go ahead.
Yeah, all right. Whatever. You've had your time. Thank you, Bill. I did say that. I don't know, maybe you didn't hear the warning. I said that anybody that supports this latest mad escalation of Bush Co. is that you're under 42, I'm going to say, get your butt down to the recruiting station. They need people. They don't have enough people. They got to keep sending people back two and three times. Think about that. There, even though 80% of the people opposes escalation, 20% of the adult population, Jalene's, you know, millions and millions, probably even tens of millions, right? And of those tens of millions, there's got to be probably enough that to make up that 20,000. But what they're going to do is they're going to be cheerleaders for war.
Right? Oh, yeah, from the sidelines, of course, yeah.
Yeah, but that's in the great tradition of Bush and Cheney. Here's Matthew in Dearborn. Matthew, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Hey, you with us? No, I got to push a button, don't I? Here you go. Ah, there you go. Matthew, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Doing good.
I actually tried to get into the Army, and they told me I was too fat, to tell you the truth. But
that's unusual, but go ahead. I'll tell you why. How much overweight were you or are you?
I was 270 pounds at the time, about 250 now, but they wanted me to get down to 200 pounds before they'd let me in.
Yeah.
It was actually really weird.
How old are you?
The truth.
How old are you? Yeah. There's weight requirements for a lot of stuff like that. Uniform, you know, police, fire, and hey, it would be good for you to get down to that 200, huh?
Oh, I don't doubt it. Tell you the truth, but yeah. Don't you think that getting into boot camp and alone would probably get me down a lot?
Well,
and a lot of my weight is a lot of muscle. You know, I got a lot of weight in my legs, and I'm about 5'10".
Well, I'm about 5'10 and a half, and I weigh 165.
Lucky you.
Well, no, I mean, I wasn't, I'm sorry, I don't, you know, people put a lot on people that are heavy, and I'm not trying to do that, but I'm
need to talk about fat politics now?
Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. We'll leave it at that. Thank you, Matthew. But
good for you for losing some weight, though, Matthew.
Who, me?
Matthew. Oh. You look great, Peter.
Well, thank you. So do you.
Listen, I don't know. Sugar has been my friend lately. It's not good.
Really?
Yeah. It's my resolution to eat really bad. I've stuck to it.
The resolution was to eat badly?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because right. I thought it'd be, you know, the reverse psychology. Anyhow.
Here's the money deal. The Pentagon is seeking nearly $100 billion for operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere, wherever the hell that is, Iran probably. Request that if approved by Congress would set an annual record for war-related spending. You know, when you talk about the military-industrial complex, folks, it's not a proper noun. It's a process whereby the average worker, you and me and the rest of us, are being looted. So this is, you know, our taxes, right? So all this money's taken from us, and then it's sent over for these endless wars. And there is so much corruption. You know, actually, I thought I had an article on that. But there's billions and billions and billions of dollars that have gone into Iraq and just disappeared into American contractors' hands, into Iraqi contractors' hands. And that was part of what you sweated your butt off for, during last week. So how in the world, just on that basis, self-interest, that people can support this is way beyond me.
I think a lot of people just don't think about that, Peter, in their daily life. They don't think about where their tax dollars go. They're worried about, you know, getting little Susie onto the soccer league and you know, that they have to go to the grocery store. You know what I'm saying?
Well, the American Friends Service Committee every year publishes a pie chart of where the money goes, where money comes from, the vast majority of it from us. And then where it goes, and this enormous amount, they would say, I don't know, they have something, it's like 6% of the budget, or, but it's weird. It's all, you know, the old thing we've always said about figures don't lie, but liars can figure. Mm-hmm. And so that enormous amount of expenditures in this society, it's really a war system. The whole system is based on preparation for war, and now, of course, for using it. Of making war, and you use all that up, and then, hey, you got to produce more, right?
Yeah, plan for the next one.
Yeah. So it's $100 billion. The request would push the total for 2007 fiscal year to nearly $170 billion, 45% more than Congress provided for 2006.
Yeah, when you and I started that old talk show that we had, what were the numbers? It was like 28 million or something like that, what they were going to spend.
No, they were going to spend, they said it.
What was it?
They fired this guy that said it would cost $200 to $300 billion.
Oh, because they knew he was right.
Yeah, they fired that General Shinecki because he said it would take 300,000 to 400,000 troops, or there would be endless resistance.
Oh, yeah.
And then I can't remember the guy. Somewhere, I don't know. But he said that it would cost $200 to $300 billion. He's gone.
He was out of it.
It was more than that. And it's going to cost, they estimate now, $2.2 trillion overall. I mean, when you factor in the cost. For the next, I mean, you're going to have veterans that have wounded, you know, these catastrophic wounds that people have suffered.
Yeah.
They're going to be, you know, we're going to be paying for them till, you know, for the next 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that I don't mind paying for. I don't mind, but they shouldn't. We shouldn't be having to pay for that in the first place.
Well, the Congressional Budget Office has found out, gee, I'm glad they spent all this money to find this out. The gap between rich and poor has widened in the last several years.
You know what? I could have told them that for free.
Yeah, I would have charged them a little, but not the millions they probably spent. Also, families earning more than $1 million a year, which is that's up to the one half of 1%, saw their federal tax rates drop more sharply than any group in the country as a result of Bush's tax cuts.
Well, that's just not surprising at all.
Yeah.
Not good to hear, but not surprising.
Wait a minute here. Let's see. We got some people talking about. All right. Here's Adam in Westland. Go ahead, Adam. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
I just wanted to talk about the height and weight standards of getting into the military.
Sure.
That gentleman that was talking that was 275 and lost 25 pounds. I just wanted to applaud him on that, on losing all the weight. But the reason that they have the height and weight standards for, you know, the recruits' safety.
Sure.
Because, you know, all the training and everything, just because they want him 200 pounds, he's still going to get out of training at about 170. You know, with
all
the...
Yeah, they work you pretty hard in that, in the training, yeah.
But he's not going to lose 50 pounds in basic training.
No, he's not. And, you know, they want people that are physically fit and that are going to be able to do the job.
So conditioned already going in, huh?
Yeah, you know, I did 4 years in the Marine Corps. I was over there during the war, and I went back a second time, and I never saw anybody that was 250 pounds, you know, over there doing their thing. Because you got about another 80 pounds of gear on you, you know, jumping out of vehicles and driving around, and, you know, they have standards, and
yeah,
it's
well, I mean,
important
they do.
That people meet it.
Yeah, and I remember I said that most uniformed services do. You same thing with police and fire.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that, Adam. Here is Matt. Matt's in Royal Oak. Matt, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing well. Thank you.
All right. I disagree with what you're saying.
What, about what? Weight standards?
No, not weight standards. We're there for a reason, and a lot of people don't understand the reason, which is we got to sit there and get rid of terrorism. And I hate Bush for screwing things up.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is we got service guys over there they're told to do.
Right.
And the bottom line is, we need to support them no matter what happens.
What do you mean by support them?
Support them is, you're sitting there saying, oh, we shouldn't be over there.
Well, that's about, you know, 60, 70, 80% of the American people are saying that.
Yeah. And I,
so why is that not supporting the troops? Some people would say, support the troops, bring them home. I'd see yellow ribbons now that say that. Support the troops, bring them home.
Are we seriously having this conversation again?
Again, yeah.
Yes, we are, because I had the yellow ribbons out there. My neighbor's grandson was over there. He did three tours with the Marine Corps. And, yes, I want to bring them all home.
Yeah.
But I understand that we have to do something over there.
Well, I don't like the we. Because that's too inclusive. These are policies formulated by a man who says that he was misinformed. I think he lied. I think he knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. And he's got us in this situation that has wound up with hundreds of thousands of people dead. I mean, can we even fathom that? Think about how we reacted to 3,000 people in our country dying on September 11, 2001. 650,000 Iraqis have been killed by Americans. I mean, that's an extraordinary amount. And, you know, what is it? Sorry about that. Collateral damage because we have certain goals. The goals don't have anything to do with terrorism. Terrorism just works for Bush's benefit. The more terrorism that he thinks that there is in the world, the more that people will support him. And they did it for a long time. But it proved that you can fool all the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. So the chickens have come home to roost for him, and now he is isolated in the bunker. And the hell with them, I say. All right, Matt, thank you. Let's see. Fred says there is a plan. Fred's in Detroit. You're on the air. Hi.
Good morning, Peter. Where should I begin?
The what?
At the beginning.
Where should you begin? Yeah. Well, yeah, Jalene's right.
Okay, let's see. Let's start with the Iraq study group.
Okay.
I have heard, including the president tonight on 60 Minutes, say, what is the Democrats' plan? They can criticize. They have nothing to offer.
Mm-hmm.
That has been one of the most monumental recent lies to come down the pike.
Well, actually, you're right.
I heard, I can't remember what party he was with, but it was on NPR the other day, a congressman say, the Iraq study group's plan is our plan. We presented it, and the president is just up and blown it off.
And John Murtha. Yeah, and John Murtha's plan for this phased, I forgot the phrase he used, but pulling back. There's got to be some way to disengage, some way also to meet our obligations to the Iraqi people whose country Bush illegally invaded and occupied and caused such death and destruction. There's got to be some way to make amends for that, at the same time disengaging us from all this fighting.
Well, I wish the Democrats would make that point known to the American public. The plan is there. And two, the surge business, I heard another congressman say, we've been surging and receding, you know, up and down for the last 3 years. It didn't work before. You know, what makes Bush think it's going to work now?
Well, you know, the only thing I can't figure out, Fred, is what in the hell does this guy have in mind? I mean, he can't, unless he just believes his own lies. You know, that when the liar lies to himself, that's when the trouble really begins. And he says he's not going to listen to the public. He's not going to listen to all these military analysts. He's not going to listen to the Congress. He is the decider. Well, every decision he's made so far has been wrong. A mission accomplished and all that. Get rid of this guy.
Now, I've listened to some of your callers over the past few weeks, and I've heard all sorts of things like the last guy or two was just on the phone.
Uh-huh.
You know, how about, killing these terrorists? How about taking a fight to them?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had that going on in Afghanistan. When you fight in Iraq, you open up a second front, and you just spread the terrorists out. Are you worried about attacks here at home? Well, how about enacting all of the security reforms that the Congress put in place or were asking for?
Yeah.
When you protect refineries, rail lines, things back here at home, then you may not have to be in Iraq.
Well, I agree. But on the other hand, we have to disengage to the point where these people have less grievances against the United States. I mean, a good part of the grievances have to do with the United States' support of tyrannical regimes in the Middle East, the occupying of the Muslim Holy Lands, you know, with troops in there, and the Iraq War. Get rid of all that, and the people that are pissed off at us would be reduced substantially. All right, Fred, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. I forgot to mention this last week. I mentioned we had a listener in Turku, Finland, Jolene. And our first listener in Finland, Jacob, in Oulu, Finland, up above the Arctic Circle, he corrected our pronunciation, mine, I guess. It's not Turku, T-U-R-K-U, but it's Thurku.
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 Okay. Yeah.
And who did I say played their Tool?
The Tool.
Henrik had written me from Thurku and said he had seen Tool there.
They get around.
They get around, those boys. They do. Where are we here? Oh, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Mike and Jackson. Mike, hi. Peter and Jolene with you.
Hello, Peter.
Hi.
I was just wanted to ask you, what about the arguments I've heard if we do pull out of Iraq? What exactly would really happen there? I just live in Jackson, Michigan. I've never been to the Middle East in my life.
Well, neither have I. I don't know. Could all go to hell. Could all go to hell with us there. I mean, what the hell is Bush doing with Iran? I mean, arresting all these people, you know, all sending in these battle groups. I mean, this could turn out to be a regional war. Or, you know, once you do great damage to a society, there's no telling what will happen. So if Bushco has created a situation where we're damned if we do and damned if we don't, we're damned if we stayed there, the death and destruction continues, and if we withdraw, there's death and destruction. Well, that doesn't leave a lot of options, do they? Other than that, maybe the person who has accepted responsibility for that, we didn't talk about that. Bush said on Wednesday, for the bad decisions that were made, which has to include the initial decision to ask for a resolution from Congress to go, it wasn't even actually the resolution. No.
1441, wasn't that the resolution?
Was it?
I think so.
Okay. But it sounds like anyway. Let's not go there. I'm totally that this guy has made mistakes all along. So there's no reason to think that suddenly he's got some brain. Suddenly he can make good decisions. Suddenly he has analyses that are worthwhile. Because everybody we know that does have some sense says this is insane. Right. So
including generals, including, yeah.
Including essentially the Iraq study group made up of his father's advisors.
That's right.
Yeah. All right, Mike, thank you.
Most of all.
There could be catastrophic consequences to withdrawal. That's, in a way, why this has to all be negotiated with all the parties there, including Syria and Iran. Rather than threatening Iran, there ought to be an engagement with them. All right, here is David. David's in Hazel Park. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
Sorry, just talk about a couple of things. I think one of the reasons why a lot of these young people are joining the military because there's, I don't think they're like supporting the war. Some are, I'm sure, but there's like no jobs out there, and a lot of them come from, you know, broken homes, and they got no alternative but to join the military because they do offer some money and schooling. So these kids, you know, they have nowhere to go.
Yeah, well, go ahead.
Yeah, and I just, you know, it kind of, what else are they supposed to do if there's no jobs out there, you know? It's tough for these kids, especially here in Michigan.
Well, I know. I don't know. I mean, I suppose, as you said, there is a variety of reasons. I mean, obviously, well, one thing they found out, it is not the real poor that join. It's mostly working class and lower middle class young people that join and see it as a way to, hopefully to
get the education,
get the training, and what have you. But they do have what they call the poverty draft, and the more that the economy suffers for people that are the potential recruits, the more recruits they're going to get. That's true. All right. Thank you. Appreciate it. Let's see. Here's AA in Detroit. Hey, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, what's going on, man? Hey, speaking from the perspective of a serviceman myself,
yeah,
I got to say this. No, I don't agree with George W. Bush. Yes, I do agree that he's a boob myself.
Okay.
But yet and still, nobody told these MFers to crash or build their planes into our buildings in the first effing place.
Well,
So therefore, 9/11.
What does 9/11 have to do with Iraq?
Do you know where those guys were from? What country?
They were from Afghanistan, but it was
No, they weren't. Do you know
it
where?
It was all backed by Saddam Hussein.
They were all from Saudi Arabia. Every single one of them.
Well,
Except for maybe one.
Yeah, yeah.
But they
all came from our
allies. But still nothing. I'm sorry, but yeah. Still nothing.
I'm sorry, but I take it personally. When these mofos crash their planes into my building.
Well, so what can you do about it? I mean, you don't want to go kill Iraqi civilians because these jihadists, mostly from Saudi Arabia, who's our supposed to be our ally. I mean, what the hell does invading Iraq have to do with 9/11? All the thing that did was make things worse.
And so Bush has gotten to you, obviously. I know you say you don't agree with him, but you're buying into his rhetoric right now by saying what you're saying. By equating 9/11 to us invading Iraq, there is no connect between the two. So Bush has gotten to you.
It's the truth.
What's the truth?
It's the truth.
That Bush has gotten to?
War is inevitable right now.
Yeah, I don't think so. But, wait a minute. You could be right. You could be right. That a war, given George Bush and the way that he's chosen to approach this disaster of his creation on September 11th, by letting the guard of the United States down, of having all the information necessary to protect the United States, and going on vacation in August of 2001, of being shown this document saying that Osama bin Laden, was planning attacks in the United States, that they had all this information about planes being hijacked and all that, and Bush just let the deal go down. That's who to be angry at, my friend. All right, stay out of harm's way. Don't harm anyone. We'll be in peace. Yeah. 313-298-WRIF. We'll be right back.
Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit. Every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101-WRIF. Everything that rocks. This is WRIF.com.
In the time of chimpanzees, I was a monkey. choking on the splinters.
On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. 1 a.m. Eastern Time, I'm going to be interviewing a couple people. Dan Georgiakis, who's written a memoir of growing up Greek in Detroit called My Detroit, Growing Up Greek in Motor City. And also, and gee, I can't even think of his name. That's terrible. But he's, Julian Jordan is with me as well. And he, the guest, is part of this Rainforest Action Network and this, what the hell is it? Something oil. This is terrible. All I got to do is write this stuff down.
Like a
right?
Healing oil? Is that what you're talking
no,
about?
No. Getting off oil.
Oh, getting off of oil. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
All
yeah.
right.
Oh, I know where that. Let me see. Where the hell did my website go? It's on my website. I'll get it as we go along. Speaking of
tune
oil.
Tune in. It's going to be good.
It's
going to
be good. Here's Mike from Canada. Mike, where are you calling from in Canada?
Well, actually, I'm in on a I-75 heading south from Detroit right now. I'm a trucker right now.
All right. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I listen to your show whenever I get a chance when I'm in the area. And the thing that I don't understand is I follow politics quite regularly, both Canadian and American, and that Bush and all the oil bigwigs, they attacked Iraq for the oil. But what gets me is that Canada supplies the United States with 50% of the oil that they use.
No.
Yes, we do. Coming out of Alberta.
50%.
Venezuela's 40. Okay, so if Canada's 50, that's 90. So if we're really only getting 10 from the Middle East,
you're not getting a lot from the Middle East. What they do is they bring it in and they ship it out.
Oh, you mean they refine it here? I don't know. Where's my Google? Whoa! We gotta. All right, we're losing you here. Whew. We're losing you here. All right. We don't want to argue about facts. And
right.
I can't get to Google.
So some comes over from Canada.
Yeah. So, yeah, Canada's a big supplier. Sure. Mexico, the United States itself provides a lot of it. Middle Eastern, Venezuelan. I don't think Venezuela supplies 40%.
I thought it was 40% at one time. Well, it may not be that anymore. But maybe also think about maybe it's the protection of that oil. And to be able to get that Middle East oil, it's not necessary.
Oh, that costs us billions and billions and billions, like this war.
Yeah.
But also, we give all this money to Egypt and Israel and Jordan and whoever the hell else. Yeah. Are we probably paying Ethiopia now to fight in Somalia?
But I think it's not just the war for oil, for future oil as well, is what I'm trying to get at. Yeah.
Well, somebody who knows or thinks they know.
About Canadian oil?
Canadian, Venezuela. Yeah, what are the percentages? Send us, email it. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. All right, here is Christian in Ann Arbor talking about ethanol. Hi, Christian. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Peter. Hi, Julian. I'm relatively ignorant about ethanol, and I was just curious, if President Bush hadn't invaded Iraq, could he have used that money, or if a Democrat had, as Al Gore had won in 2000, could they have used that surplus to develop ethanol research? Like I said, I don't really know too much.
Well, yeah, and cancer, and rebuilding the country's infrastructure, and giving us a national health program. I mean, if these figures, and I have no reason to doubt them, the ones that are projected of $2.2 trillion this war is going to wind up costing us, and of course that money in the main is going to these corporations that are linked into Bushco. That's why I call it that. It's Bush Incorporated. It's this racket. It's institutionalized looting of the American people. That this money, or even if you want to just talk about direct expenditures, which I think now is about $300 billion or a little more, that any of that could have been used for alternative sources. The oil companies who wound up winning essentially, because they don't want cheap oil. They want to have a source of oil, but they're happy with the way things are going, and they think they're going to eventually wind up with Iraqi oil anyway. They want to keep us on oil. They don't want to get us on ethanol. They don't want to get us on solar power or biomass or anything like that.
Where do they do the development for that type of research? Do they do that at public universities where they could funnel money into public universities to get more students to go back to school instead of having them join the military to get that education?
Well, the universities do a lot of research. In fact, the oil companies, they do alternative energy research. They don't do a lot of it, but there's some of them. Some companies are more committed to it than others. I don't know if you can believe their advertising, like BP. They always have these big advertisements saying how they're committed to alternative sources. I mean, ultimately, it's the oil that they make extravagant, extraordinary profits from. All right, sir. Thank you very much. It's a good question. But yeah, sure. With that kind of money, hundreds of billions of dollars.
Bring on the ethanol.
Yeah, or whatever. Let's have a little solar-powered cars.
The grease from the fast food, whatever.
Yeah. Here is Stan in Garden City. Stan, hi. You're on the air.
Good evening. How's everybody doing tonight?
Good, good. Thank you, sir.
I got a two-fold question, Peter, for you and your friend. I forget her name. What's your name?
Julene.
Very nice talking to you. First question is a constitutional question, and the question would be with the Patriot Act. Question regarding, does the Patriot Act now usurp or trump the Constitution of the United States, as the media is talking, to where the Democrats cannot cut funding for the troops, and where the Constitution is no longer valid?
Well, the Patriot Act doesn't affect funding for the troops. And
that's a great question.
Yeah, but does it trump the Constitution? Well, it trumps it in the sense that I'm sure that it'll eventually, great sections of it will be declared unconstitutional. There's been all sorts of laws throughout American history that have been passed by the Congress and signed by the president that have eventually been overturned.
I see. My second question is quick. With the buildup on the borders of the ocean of near Iran, I'm worried that they got two more aircraft carriers going into the oceans over by Iran. Do you think they're going to pull a rabbit out of their hat while a president's still in office and attack Iran, these nuclear power plants? And I'll leave the rest to you because it looks kind of scary the way things are going. He looks really desperate to do something.
Well, I don't know what that would do for him. That's what I don't understand. I mean, one of the things that Napoleon said was that the only thing you cannot do with bayonets is to sit on them. In other words, if you have military weaponry poised, it's probably going to be used. In fact, there's something that just impels it along the way to war. But what in the world would Bush gain by an attack on Iran, except, and this could be, as I said earlier, the desire to create chaos, because it is within chaos, within death and destruction, that Bush thrives. If everything's going along, well, people realize what a evil buffoon he is. So the idea that he, in fact, could want to engender attacks on the United States, I mean, that's pretty conspiratorial, but I wouldn't put anything at all past these evil clowns. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here is Nick. Nick is in Macomb Township. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, Pete?
Doing good.
Doing good. Nice to hear you, man. I was just concerned about that 200,000 troop surge.
Well, it's not that big. 20,000.
20,000, I apologize. Yeah. It's a long day. But I'm, I'm 19 years of age. When I turned 18, I had to sign up for the draft. And personally, that's something that really concerns me because, one, I do not believe in the war at all. I do not know why we're there fighting that war. I've heard all kinds of reasons. Oh, we're fighting terrorism. Oh, weapons of mass destruction. Which one is it?
Well, they've got a new reason all along. Now that we'll lose all this credibility if we withdraw. I mean,
see, we already lost our credibility with Bush.
Yeah, well, sure, and that's itself fulfilling. We go in there, under false information, I think purposely false information, lies, and then we have to stay there because we're there, and we can't lose because we've already committed ourselves. So
exactly.
Where's the end? Yeah, where's the end of it? We don't know.
Just like you were saying, there's, we're already there. Either we can continue the chaos and destruction or, what happens if we pull out.
Well, I said earlier, Nick, too, that of all the things to be concerned about, I don't think the draft is one of them. Because whoever proposed a draft, there, for one thing, you would have an enormous mass movement of young people and their parents that would probably make the 60s look like a walk in the park. Yeah. Because for what everybody says about supporting the, supporting our troops, and that's what they want to do, support them. They don't want to be a troop. That's it. Anyways, Bush is saying, support our oops, right? That's it. Support our oops.
Oh, that's good, Peter.
Yeah. I stole it from somewhere.
I like that
one. Yeah. But no one's, the support of the troops was, rah, rah. Let's beat the drum for our boys in Iraq, but most of the people that still, the few people, a small percentage of people that still support the war, and they're of service age, they ain't going over there. They have no intention of doing that. They want the people that are there to do it. All right, thank you, Nick. Appreciate it. Let's see, here is Marianne in Dearborn. Hi, Marianne, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Julian.
Hi.
Some of these clowns who are calling in favor of a war remind me of these guys that, when I was in Petoskey last summer, buying some stuff at a dollar store, they were all talking about how much they were for the war. Forgive me, I'm on pain medication and everything. And, people were giving up, 5, 10, 15, 20 bucks, whatever they could give, just in toilet paper and toothpaste and stuff to the troops because our government isn't supplying it.
Yeah.
And so people were donating money. And I turned around and I said to him, I said, listen, why don't you give up some money if you support the troops? These poor guys are over there and they don't even have basic things, basic hygiene and grooming things. Why don't you part with some of your money? And he just looked at me like I was crazy. And I stood to one side and watched him and his friend walk up. And I said, he didn't think that I was watching. I said, I didn't see you part with so much as a buck, buddy. I said, if you're so for it, why can't you even give these poor people what they need?
Yeah, I hear you. All right, Marianne, thank you. I hope your pain is relieved. Thank
Good
you
job
for joining
speaking
us.
Out there.
And Al, we never thank Al. Al, actually, we might need another call or two, so don't shut the lines off. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Bill in Sumter Township. Hey, Bill, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Doing good, thanks.
Pretty good. I was going to say that I think you guys are doing a great job trying to supply everybody with information. And so all the people out there who want to ask questions about what's going on, they should, how am I explaining this? Before they argue with you about your ideas or
opinions,
there you go, that they should look up things on the Internet and read more about what's going on over there. Because it seems like all the people are kind of confused on the lies and the truths of things,
Yeah.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Exactly right. And I guess that's all I got to say.
Well, thank you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Great point.
Well said indeed. Yeah, I forgot. We asked people to call in about... this source says Canada supplies 18% of all oil imports to the U.S.
That sounds a little bit better.
Yeah.
Or more accurate.
Crude oil and total petroleum imports, top 15. Oh, man, I don't think I can read this.
Top 15 countries.
Yeah. Okay. There's just too much text here. I can't do
all
it.
Right.
Digger, thank you.
For next week, huh?
Yeah, I'll have to look at that. Canadian oil from Chris writes in. Oh, man. It's all... I'm sorry, guys. I appreciate you sending this in. I got to get here. Steve says, same Steve, 15%.
Okay, so between 15 and 20 average, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know who... what I'd like to see is how much U.S. supplies of itself. Is my voice going or what?
Well, good thing.
Yeah.
10 minutes left.
Didn't I used to do a three-hour show?
You did.
All right. let's see. Here in Troy is Dan. Dan, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Grow your hair, burn a billboard, and plant a tree.
Nice.
Stop driving. Ride your bike.
Yeah.
Recycle. Oh, man. No more George.
I got you.
All
right.
We all said that 5, 7, 12, 20 years ago, but time for change. Big time.
Big time. Thank you, Dan. Thank you very much. Here in Windsor, Brian, thank you for making our program international. Go ahead.
Oh, no problem. I was just talking about how all the different religious sects in Iraq will never let it settle. They're always fighting each other, and that it all the whole situation started there back in when the British made all one big country instead of letting it subjugate into the surrounding country the same religion.
Right.
And now we have that. Now we have this big problem there, and it will never really settle. And as much as we may hate to admit it, Saddam did keep Iraq together, and he was the only thing. It was just without him now, it's going to fall apart.
Well, as we said earlier in the show, that that Bush's daddy knew that. That's why he kept Saddam in power following the 1991 first Gulf War. That he knew that if he marched into Baghdad and tried to pacify it, that they would be met with what? Sectarian violence and insurgency.
Exactly. And I believe back after the end of World War II, how long was the U.S. in Germany?
After?
After the Soviet Union conquered Berlin, how long was the U.S. in Germany? Don't they still have air bases there and stuff like that?
Oh yeah, they're sure. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So I think I don't mean to be critical, but I think that it's a little impatient to believe you can rebuild a country in 5, 6 years.
Well,
it takes a lot longer to lay a foundation for a country. The U.S. wasn't founded in 5, 6 years.
I'll tell you, the war in Iraq has now lasted longer than the Second World War in Europe. So, all of that. All right, I got to take some more quick calls. Thank you for yours. Here is Chuck in Davison. Chuck, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just like to make a couple quick comments. I watched Bush's speech on the computer the other night, and I haven't laughed so much in ages. You know. But then it started sinking in that, you know, this idiot is our leader, and what these foolish ideas we have are actually our national policy, and that's kind of sad.
Then you got depressed, yeah.
Yeah, second. But then I got a friend, he works at UPS, and he has a friend who drives a car that runs on ethanol,
because
he takes oil from restaurants. Costs about 50 cents to turn into gas when he drives to work. The only problem is his car smells like a barbecue all the time.
Well, I've heard people
say... Hey, that's not so bad.
Yeah, I've heard people say that their cars, they run on that stuff that smell like French fries.
Yeah, Willie Nelson.
Willie Nelson. I thought, doesn't his car run on hemp oil?
I think he did the fast food thing for his tour bus.
Okay.
But knowing Willie, it is on hemp oil.
It is.
Go right. Willie.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. And here's Lars in Madison Heights. Lars, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I wanted to talk about the 20,000 troops are going to be sending to Iraq.
Sure.
Well, I think the only way they could do it is if they took out a lot of time training. When I was in the Marines, you'd be surprised like what we actually consider training. Most of it's just walking around the woods with guns going bang, 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 and basically doing Vietnam-era tactics in the woods when we're going to be sending people to, you know, do room clearing in urban environments.
Wow.
And out of like a 7-month, you know, training buildup, you might have at roughly 2 weeks worth of actual urban fighting that would actually be useful to you. The rest is just what they consider the basics, going to the woods, digging holes. You know, it's like, okay, is this the place where we get attacked by thermal platoon? And you hear like, bang, bang, bang. Okay, I guess we're being attacked. Contact right. Bang, bang, bang. Okay, that was good.
So you really think these guys are going to be going into harm's way, for one thing? They're really going to be fighting urban guerrilla warfare? I don't want to go into the whole thing about Jenin, the Israeli invasion of the Palestinian city, and all that involved. But, they're going to be fighting who? They're going to be fighting these Shiite death squads. Well, these Shiite death squads are supporters of the Baghdad government that the United States supports. I mean, none of this makes a bit of sense at all. Thank you, Lars. Let's see here. Here is Mark in Hazel Park. Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm just getting over a cold, so if I cough, I'll just hang up.
Me too.
George Bush, every time he's asked about his cocaine addiction, he says that's in the past.
Right.
And I believe people should contact their representative and suggest that they enact something that prevents another addict to take over our government. Because it's obvious that his addiction went from drugs and alcohol to power and war.
Now, some people say that he's a what they call a dry drunk.
That's what they say.
Yeah.
He fits the bill, but, you know, he's his whole addiction seems to be war. He won't listen to anybody.
No.
He won't listen to reason. His mind is incapable of reason, it seems.
He won't even listen to his own daddy.
We all know he snorted up half of Peru.
Yeah, well, he had
come
income.
On.
He had the income to get it.
Yeah,
you
he
seen
did.
Those nostrils lately?
Yeah.
Jeez.
He in general.
He could do like an eight ball in one line.
I don't even know what that is.
Me neither. I've just heard it.
Jillian Jordan, thanks a lot. Are you going to be on the air, at 2 a.m.?
I am, yes.
Right up till
with
noon,
my,
right?
With my own personal Mountain Dew.
Oh,
that
man.
Will be, I don't need
that's got more
Peru.
Caffeine than Starbucks.
I got to go till Drew and Mike, Peter.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Thank you, Jillian. Thank you, Al, for doing the hard work of screening all the calls and screening some of them out. And we'll talk again next week.
You're listening to WRIF.com. More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. We're all excited in the Motor City, right, because we are the Motor City. And coming right at us for the next couple of weeks, the North American International Auto Show. But all of us call it the Detroit Auto Show, the home of mass production of the cars, now, of course, extended all across the planet. Great celebration, great interest, the papers and the radio locally, and actually nationally, and to some extent internationally, just filled with the concept cars and lots of other aspects of automobile production and what have you. Well, we are going to talk about the what have you, because there's other aspects to automobiles that probably are not addressed very much at the auto show. But joining us is Matt Leonard. He's a campaigner for the Freedom from Oil campaign. It's a project of the Rainforest Action Network. And Matt Leonard, welcome to Detroit, and welcome to the Detroit Auto Show.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Yeah, and so your concerns aren't about the hippest-looking car, the most stylish, and to some extent even the production concerns and the profitability of the automobile companies in Michigan and Detroit as much as what cars do to the environment. Is that the case?
Largely our concern is about the environmental impacts, but I think the environmental impacts of automakers and the fuel efficiency specifically is very tied to the profitability of, especially of the Detroit automakers. So to some degree, those concerns overlap.
Now, that's always been addressed, at least somewhat, in past Detroit auto shows. And is there more of, are the companies addressing the question of fuel efficiency more this year?
Well, addressing can mean many things. They're certainly talking about it more than they have in past years.
They have their electric cars.
They do. GM has made several very large announcements the past few days. I mean, I think society is at a point where everyone's talking about environmental impacts, from, you know, Al Gore's big movie, The Inconvenient Truth, to simply being something that's on everyone's kind of around the table dinner talk. And automakers are no exception to that. They're also talking very heavily about their environmental impacts. But what our job really is here at the auto show is to make sure that their talk about the environmental concerns actually translates into their vehicles and into their production and actually makes substantial improvements towards their environmental impacts rather than just being marketing or being hype.
Now, who are you speaking to? Are you speaking to the public? Are you going to have if we go down there, or when we go down there, are we going to see an information table, or are you trying to talk directly to the people that are making decisions about this?
Definitely both. I mean, we want to send a strong message to the automakers that there is a very large consumer demand for fuel-efficient cars, and that's something that I think has been growing, that course has been growing very strongly over the past few months with the soaring gas prices. So we're definitely sending a message to the automakers, but we also want to talk to consumers, too, because consumers are definitely feeling, you know, the pain of soaring gas prices most heavily when they go to the pump and try to fill up. And so we want to connect with consumers and show them that there are ways where we can actually get ourselves away from our dependence on oil and develop fuel-efficient cars, and that automakers need to be able to respond to consumer demands and give us the cars we want.
All of us, of course, would like cheap fuel, but that does drive larger cars and fuel-inefficient cars like the one that I have. I just have a full-size sedan. I know, shame on me. But there's a lot of reasons that people have big vehicles. Some of them kind of mysterious to me. Others concerns with safety, with room, and all of that. But certainly, when we start looking at, as we did before the 2006 elections, where gas prices were starting to get up over $3, people were saying, "Well, maybe I should get a Prius or something like that." Now, I just coming in, $1.99. So even below the $2 figure. So people get environmental consciousness, it seems, when it's hitting their pocketbook.
I think it's both. I mean, being from California, I'm actually surprised at how cheap gas is here versus in California. But regardless, I think, you know, every major analyst and even President Bush himself acknowledges that in coming years, oil is going to be a very volatile commodity, and it's going to fluctuate with prices. And while we may have cheap gas right now, we didn't have it 6 months ago, and we probably aren't going to have it, you know, 6 months in the future. And those are things that are kind of going to be a given based on, you know, kind of a whole set of issues that are kind of generally called energy security. So I think if automakers really want to win back consumers, they need to make cars that are going to be fuel efficient for the long term. I mean, right now, Detroit is laying off tens of thousands of workers and also losing billions of dollars in profits because they have relied on large platform cars and trucks like SUVs and big pickups people don't want, and they're sitting on lots and unable to sell, whereas a lot of foreign automakers have been producing more fuel-efficient cars, and Toyota, for example, is leaping, you know, very quickly to catch up to GM as the largest car maker in the world. So there's a number of great studies out showing that if Detroit automakers, U.S. automakers, were actually going to take a proactive stance on building fuel-efficient vehicles, they would actually have a much stronger profitability than if they, simply like continued it kind of at the status quo of building gas-guzzling vehicles.
You know, I was driving last summer a small sports car a friend of mine had, and I don't know what to ascribe it to, but I was like almost frightened. You couldn't even see me. I'm sure it was surrounded by these enormous SUVs and these Ford 150s and all of that. And when I said earlier about why I drive a large sedan, part of it is a thing of security and safety. So I want to have a little bit bigger metal than these very small, say like the, I don't know how big the GM, is it the GM Volt? Is that who makes the Volt, the electric car? Or the for instance, the one that they had in California for a few years. That just scares the hell out of me. So, I mean, I don't know if that's much of a factor in people choosing automobiles, but it is with me.
Well, there's definitely a lot of, I think, misinformation put out there regarding vehicle safety, and it's not entirely true that larger is safer.
No. Well, no, those big SUVs and the big 150s are. I mean, I've got a real low, I can say it, a Taurus. Those have a pretty good safety rating. Those SUVs, they tend to tip, don't they?
Mm-hmm. There's tipping issues, and there's also, I mean, a lot of the safety features that automakers are pushing are actually can be implemented regardless of vehicle size, such as airbags and different kinds of types of materials and composite materials and crush zones. And so there's a number of good studies commissioned, including by the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, showing that larger doesn't necessarily equate to being safer. And automakers certainly can produce very safe vehicles that can be fuel efficient and can be smaller. Mm-hmm. They can even produce larger vehicles that are more fuel efficient.
Matt Leonard's my guest. He's a campaigner with the Freedom From Oil campaign, and he's in town for the Detroit Auto Show. At some point, though, no matter how fuel-efficient cars get, if you start having millions and millions of more cars on the road, you're going to wind up with the same problems. I don't know if you saw this in the New York Times the other day. Car boom puts Europe on a road to a smoggy future. Did you happen to see this?
I haven't seen that specific article, but we've been talking to some European car activists as well. And
so in Europe, in Dublin, is the case here, is that that they've actually, it's become a zero sum in terms of how they've reduced factory pollution, and there's been such a rise because of the growth of the Irish economy that so many people have cars. Not only is there just massive gridlock all across Dublin, the pollution levels are about the same. And now we look at China being a major auto producer. Maybe the cars are just going to choke us all to death. Matt says,
Well,
I agree.
Personally, I think there needs to be a bigger movement towards developing more public transit and mass transit options. And that's something that historically Europe has certainly been far more advanced on than has the United States. But we're certainly seeing an increase of that in the United States as well, as we do see more congestion, more smog. But one of the big goals of our campaign is actually to move beyond oil altogether and develop emissions-free vehicles. And things like electric vehicles, which were a successful test program in California several years ago, are one step towards that.
Well, you, Matt Leonard, and me are very serious about these things because we see the end result of what automobile transportation does to the environment. Yet, in many ways, and this I think shows in the attendance levels that are so high always. Cars have always been, since their inception here in the Detroit area, this fantasy of prowess, of speed, of masculinity, of sexy, and we're like raining on their parade. I mean, to me, I hate to say this, folks, but to me, cars are a lot like refrigerators. I mean, I've had Ford convertibles, I've had cool cars in the past. Maybe it's my age, I don't know. But right now, I just want a car that'll safely get me from here to there, and as Matt Leonard, our guest, is saying, hopefully with better fuel efficiency. But I would think, because you've been down to some of the previews already at the Detroit Auto Show, that the concerns there are mostly have to do, when you move beyond the economic, which is very important to our area, it's all about sexy, not about what's coming out the tailpipe.
I definitely think that those two aren't mutually exclusive. Like, we can have cars that are sporty, that are sexy, that are powerful, and still have fuel efficiency with that. I think if anyone's seen the documentary Who Killed the Electric Car that's currently out, GM produced the EV1 several years ago, which by most people's calculations, was a very sexy vehicle. It was incredibly fast, it was incredibly sporty, and also had no emissions. It was a completely electric vehicle. And that's a good example when, you know, if Americans do want to be innovators and lead, you know, reclaim their role as leadership in the auto industry, we need to create cars that are both those things, that are affordable, that are fun to drive, and also responsible in terms of their impacts on the environment and their ecological footprint.
Let me just give you a little footnote here. Matt Leonard quickly said a very important documentary called Who Killed the Electric Car? Not only is it an excellent documentary, but features two Detroiters, Stan and Iris Obshinsky, who have been developing battery technology that would allow for electric cars to go much farther than they currently are, at least, it allows them to go further. But also, in fact, Iris Obshinsky just passed away not so long ago, and many of you know Harvey Obshinsky, their son, who for a long time was on WABX, a very early rock station in Detroit. His son now, Noah, is a commentator on National Public Radio, and Iris Obshinsky just lately passed away. But it's an excellent film, and the two of them, vibrant at the time of this video, have the last word in the film. Okay, all right. That little aside. There's other issues, though, that besides just greenhouse gas emissions and that have to do with fuel efficiency. Right now, in fact, it's been pretty clear because of the law that the Iraqi parliament is being asked to pass that the war in Iraq is a war about oil. So when I don't even know if that's debated anymore, but dependence on foreign fuel and foreign oil does cause some pretty deep problems, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think oil is one of those things where it's, you know, both a huge issue for the environmental impacts, but also the human rights impacts in terms of where do we get our oil from. A lot of times it's from, a lot of ecosystems and regions that are politically unstable, such as the Middle East, or that are fragile in terms of their environmental impacts, like in Alaska, or a lot of offshore drilling. But also historically in a lot of places where there's a lot of indigenous communities that are basically uprooted and taken from their land to get that oil. So it's definitely in the environment, or the impacts around fuel efficiency and oil consumption are not just environmental, but they're very much rooted in human rights, in global issues, and economic issues, environmental issues, and also here at home in labor issues, as we see that, you know, Detroit specifically in Michigan is losing so many jobs and so much economic boost to their local economies because of automakers refusing to address fuel economy and losing their market share.
I wonder, and this just popped into my mind, what would happen to many of these economies if we suddenly got smart and completely got off of foreign oil? That would put Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, Iran, Iraq, Venezuela, a lot of other countries in a pretty sad state of affairs.
It very well could, and I don't think, you know, realistically we're not going to turn a switch and suddenly be off oil, as much as, you know, that might improve some things in this world. It's going to be a process to get towards that. And that's one of the biggest things we're here doing at the auto show is really trying to get automakers to start beginning that process and address it seriously and set, you know, their priorities to be around fuel economy and actually start developing technologies that will help wean our dependence off that oil in the coming years. This auto show has generated a lot of press coverage due to General Motors unveiling the Volt, which is their electric car.
Mm-hmm.
And from all signs, it seems like it's going to be a great vehicle. But our biggest concern is that they haven't listed a production date for that. It's a concept car mm-hmm. that, you know, looks great, and it actually is a very sexy car as well by most people's interpretations. But there's no scheduled date for when it's going to be on the road or when you or I might be able to have one in our driveway.
Well, sometimes when I see target dates and people will say by 2020 we want to reduce emissions of a factory or by automobiles by 10% or 20%, given what we're experiencing now in terms of global warming, I wonder how much time we actually have. In other words, I suspect, Matt Leonard, when you and the Freedom from Oil campaign and the Rainforest Action Network go someplace, you don't want to seem like wild-eyed radicals, whereas I happily will assign that. But you're, you know, I can just say whatever. You're actually trying to affect policy. So that if you say, I think we ought to abolish all cars, people would go on to the next booth pretty quickly. On the other hand, I wonder how much more the planet can take, and we don't want, and I'm sure you don't want to be put in a position of saying, please, sir, don't kill everything so soon, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how does one deal with those unknown physical deadlines in the future and the idea that you can be effective by being realistic, if you will?
Well, like I said, we definitely, you know, have a vision of having transportation be an issue where consumers can be able to purchase zero emissions vehicles and do it affordably and have vehicles that are actually responsibly produced, that are union made, that employ good people and good jobs, and that don't damage the environment. But we're not there, and we're not going to be there for you know, the near future. So we definitely are big believers in the interim steps to get there. And that's one of the biggest things we're here in Detroit doing is trying to get automakers to have some accountability and responsibility for maintaining our dependence on oil. There's a lot of steps that automakers can take to actually begin, like I said, begin that process towards developing fuel-efficient vehicles and removing our dependence on that oil. But largely it's been relegated to marketing and kind of greenwash. And our goal here is actually make it become some solid steps for the automakers. And also to educate consumers about what steps they can take as well.
Yeah, explain the term greenwash. I think that's very important.
Sure. Greenwash is it's largely a marketing term used when companies and marketing agencies try to portray a product or their company as having a green or an environmental image. Unfortunately, a lot of times companies put a lot of money into that marketing and very little of it actually into the product development of whatever they happen to what industry they work in. For instance, like with General Motors, we do have this Volt electric vehicle, which is a great idea, and we sincerely hope they will produce it. But at this point, it's a concept car. And until actually we can see the vehicle in people's driveway, or at least get a commitment from General Motors that they will produce this car by such and such date, it really is marketing at this point. And I do have faith that General Motors is putting some resources into that, but we feel they actually need to commit to that rather than just talk about it.
You said earlier, before the Detroit Auto Show is open to the public, that you were, when it is open to the public, you certainly want to be speaking to us, but also you said you wanted to be speaking to the people that are making the policy decisions. Do you have access, or is this just that the table or the booth is there, and in that manner you'll speak to them? I mean, do you actually have access to these people, or do they wall themselves off?
We unfortunately were not allowed to be at the auto show this year. We did try our best, but for many reasons, I think auto show officials weren't.
So you don't have a.
We don't have an actual booth there.
Oh, okay.
We do have another number of public demonstrations and literature available. We've been handing out to people that are attending the auto show. And in terms of other dialogue, we have been in dialogue with Ford Motors in the past and are trying to engage in dialogue with General Motors as well. But unfortunately, a lot of these companies, you know, like I said, they want to portray a green image, but they don't actually want to do that follow through. And organizations like ours that are actually trying to hold them accountable, you know, to their marketing messaging, there's a little bit of uneasiness there.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of our goal is if we could build relationships with those automakers and actually change policy, but it's a project to get to that point.
Well, no bureaucratic organization, whether it's an auto company or the government or even like a city hall, ever enjoys pressure from the outside. They like to make their own decisions. They'll give lip service to serving the public or being elected officials and representing community interests, but ultimately they usually find groups trying to influence policy to be something they'd rather wasn't there. So it just means you got to pile on the pressure all the more. Right?
Absolutely.
My guest is Matt Leonard. He's a campaigner with the Freedom From Oil campaign, part of the Rainforest Action Network. You can go to freedomfromoil.org. I'll have a link on my site, peterwerbe.com. That's W-E-R-B-E. The Freedom From Oil campaign initially was a campaign aimed exclusively at the Ford Motor Company. Am I correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Tell us a little about that and whether it had successes or not. Because we've always thought of it as the green company. They have a nice, they have a roof that's all made out of grass and everything. So they must be environmentally conscious, right?
Yeah. The campaign started several years ago, and it was originally called Jumpstart Ford. And it's a coalition between Rainforest Action Network, which is an environmental organization, Global Exchange, which is a human rights organization, and the Rucka Society. And we specifically directed our energies at Ford because for roughly 20 out of the past 30 years, Ford has been the worst in the industry in terms of fuel economy of their average fleet. And they also, as you said, Peter, bill themselves as the environmental company. Their Rouge River plant features a living roof, and they do very much advertise and market their kind of green technological changes at some of their factories. But our biggest concern is that, while it's great to recycle more at your production plants or to have a living roof at one of your factories, the real ecological impacts from their company is on the actual vehicles they produce. And consistently, they have the worst fuel economy in the industry. And then about the past month or so, we've actually changed the name of the campaign to be Freedom From Oil, And kind of an effort to broaden our focus to see, basically put a call out to any major auto manufacturer to encourage any one of them to actually step up to the plate, prioritize fuel economy, and actually win recognition as the true environmental leader. Mm-hmm. And we would be great to see if Ford can do that, and we hope they will. They certainly have the most to gain from doing that. But we would actively encourage, you know, General Motors or Toyota or Honda or anyone else to step to that challenge as well.
Well, one of the things, of course, we've seen over the history of this country is that corporations, when left to their own, you know, their own inclinations, have employed child labor, worked people 14 hours a day, had no safety conditions, no pensions, nothing. So, and usually they were brought kicking and screaming by mass movements like in the 1930s, the unions, or the demand by the citizenry for progressive legislation earlier than that. So what we're put in the position, I say we, you know, the public that want you know, less air pollution, but often want our big cars, that that we're sort of asking them. I mean, it is sort of the thing what I said, please, sir, don't kill everything so soon, whereas that, like child labor was abolished by government law, and that the right to organize into unions was recognized by federal statute, governs that are these what's called CAFE standards. Remind me, it's right out of my brain.
Sure. CAFE is the corporate average fuel economy.
Right, which has not changed in years, and it could be by the stroke of the pen changed to ensure that the companies, the auto companies, did, because they wouldn't have any choice. So is there effort, legislative effort on your part to have that become law?
Yeah. A little background on CAFE. It was basically after the oil crisis of the 70s, CAFE was introduced because the U.S., at the federal level, recognized that fuel efficiency was a major factor in our oil dependency and was a national security issue, essentially. And fuel economy almost doubled in the first few years of CAFE being implemented. And then due to heavy lobbying from the auto industry, CAFE standards have basically remained the same for the past decade or so. So average fuel economy in the industry now is actually worse than it was 10 years ago. And most recently, there's been a big push to raise the fuel economy standards again and begin like an incremental progressive increase to address fuel economy and thus oil dependency. And actually General Motors specifically, but the entire auto industry has been up in arms with Bob Lutz from General Motors claiming very, very loudly that any increase in CAFE standards would essentially bankrupt the U.S. auto industry.
And the UAW goes along with that. They've opposed any rise in the CAFE standards.
Yeah, largely. Yeah. And unfortunately, that's the same thing that they said in the 70s, that fuel economy couldn't be increased, and it was, and they were forced to do it, and car companies still survived through it. And again, today, it must happen as well. So there is definitely a strong push at the, you know, at the federal and the policy level to raise fuel economy standards. But our angle is that we really believe that automakers and the markets have a responsibility to do that proactively. And so we, you know, think that automakers need to take the lead themselves and actually set some fuel economy priorities for themselves and actually set some benchmarks. And consumers need to actually work to hold them accountable to do that. And it'd be great if it happened at the federal government level, but our priority is definitely doing it at the market level.
All right. Madeline, maybe this isn't fair, but okay. I've got this big Taurus. It's crappy mileage. It's a long story. I actually looked at some Japanese models, and I used to work for the UAW, too. That's one of the reasons I bought the Taurus. But so next car, what would you advise me to get? It's like tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
Okay.
That's fast.
Next day.
But
I'm not going to do it, but I mean now.
We're definitely seeing a big change in the next few years at the auto industry in terms of what the vehicles that are being offered are. Fuel economy is becoming a priority, absolutely, initially for consumers, and that's why a lot of automakers are having a hard time selling their big trucks and SUVs right now. And automakers, their product offerings are starting to respond to address that change in consumer demand. But surely there's a lot of great hybrids out there that are getting improved gas mileage, and there's even a lot of non-hybrids that get great gas mileage as well. So I think we're going to start to see some changes in that, where we'll see both some smaller cars as well as automakers implementing fuel-efficient technologies into existing vehicles, as well as a lot of new vehicles that are going to be coming out. Like there's a lot more hybrids coming out from all the six automakers, as well as potentials for more plug-in hybrids. And Smart Car, which actually is a European company, is going to be offering vehicles in the U.S. as well.
Ooh, those are too little. For
little two-seaters, great fuel economy, park them anywhere.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. So we should look for you where? Outside of the Detroit Auto Show?
We'll be outside the Auto Show a few days, and you can also check out the website, which is, as you said, www.freedomfromoil.org.
Thank you so much, Matt Leonard, for being with us.
Thank you, Peter.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
What did you expect to find? Was it something you left behind? Don't you remember anything I said when I said, jump away? The thing meant to myself, jump away and leave life.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A lot of people going down to the Detroit Auto Show this coming week, and they're going to say, hey, let's go to Greektown. And normally, that's what people know about Detroit's Greek population, that there's a Greektown, and that's about it. Well, there's an immense amount more, both in history and its contemporary sighting. And joining me is an old friend of mine, Dan Georgiakis. He's written a book called My Detroit, Growing Up Greek and American in Motor City. And Dan Georgiakis is director of the Greek American Studies Project at the Center for Byzantine and Modern Greek Studies at Queens College City, University of New York, and an adjunct associate professor at the Center for Global Affairs at New York University. He's written 14 books. Most of them deal with ethnic identity, mass media also, labor history, and poetry. He may be most known in our city for Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, which chronicles the history of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers and actually mentions me, I think, three times. Dan Georgiakis, welcome home.
How you doing, Peter?
Well, let's do this, because you speak about this in your book, My Detroit, Growing Up Greek and American in Motor City, about pronunciations of Greek names. So if you were in your hometown or your family's hometown in Greece, they wouldn't say Georgiakis?
They'd say Konstantinos Georgiakas.
Georgiakas. I like that a lot better. But you say that if people try, hey...
Mr. G, I hear I had students calling Mr. G for 30 or 40 years now, and it's fine with me. I think in terms of all difficult names or unusual names, as long as somebody's making a good faith effort or fooling around with you, I think that's fine. If you take offense, I think you're foolish.
Well, maybe we could even start. It's an odd way to back into your memoir, My Detroit, Growing Up Greek and American in Motor City. Hey, tell me about the loss of the definite article there. That's sometimes the way I think of people from Eastern and Southern Europe. They don't have the definite article. Was that intentional?
It just seemed to sound right. I thought it was very Detroitish.
Yeah. Growing up Greek and American in Motor City.
Yeah, not in the Motor City. Which right. they actually, the publisher wanted to say the Motor City. I said, no, it's just Motor City, you know.
All right. Now, and I say back into it like this. Probably Detroiters and the rest of the country may know the most about Greeks in Detroit through the novel Middlesex by Jeffrey, I call him Eugenides.
Pretty good, yes.
Is that it?
That's it.
Oh, hey, pretty good. Yeah. Well, all right. But there's a lot more. I mean, how much, and a lot of, probably most people haven't read Middlesex, but was that realistic? Was that how Dan Georgakis grew up in Motor City?
No, it's not how Dan Georgakis grew up. And I guess I should say two things. My book's about Detroit. It's about Greeks, but it's about all the other ethnic groups in the city as well. And I think with Eugenides' book, which was written post-67, and he grew up in Grosse Pointe and looks back on the 1950s. Well, I was living in Detroit in the 1950s, and my book is about the very same community, actually, that he writes about. We have some decidedly different takes on it, and I think it has to do with the fact that I grew up in the city before 67, and he grew up in the area after 67.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us just a little about your background, and when you find out somebody came from Detroit, another city, you always say, what high school did you go to? So just give us that.
I'm a East Sider, a Far East Sider, went to Southeastern High School, went to Jackson Intermediate, went to Clark Elementary, taught at Finney, also taught at Cass Tech, and I spent the first 25 or so years of my life in the city of Detroit, going through all its institutions, including Wayne State University,
now,
which was then just Wayne University.
What is the significance of growing up Greek? I mean, all of us have some that are Euro-Americans, have some European background, and I mean, people normally wouldn't say, I don't think, growing up German in Detroit or growing up Italian or maybe growing up Jewish, maybe that would have a unique aspect to it. Did growing up Greek in Detroit have a uniqueness to it?
Well, it was certainly unique as far as I was concerned, and I say a story which is put in the book that when I went to kindergarten and the teacher didn't speak Greek, I thought she wasn't very well educated. But that was funny because I grew up in a neighborhood like most people in Detroit with all kinds of ethnic groups. I knew most people weren't Greek. I just thought everybody who was educated knew Greek. And I guess what has been... I didn't realize this until recently, actually. I always had an ethnic identification for some reason, which was very strong. So when I hung around with people, they often called me the Greek, even though they didn't call Doug Armento the Italian, and they didn't call Abood the Arab, but somehow I was the Greek. And what it allowed me to do is to see America always from a slightly different point of view. On the one hand, totally American, understanding the system. On the other hand, always... somehow a step aside, looking at it from the outside a little bit. And I think because both my parents and my grandparents were born overseas, that we always kind of looked at things and we could say, oh, that's the way the Americans do things, even though we were Americans.
Well, why is there such a strong ethnicity to Greeks? I mean, it's certainly this is the Greek town tourist in me. I think of all the wonderful restaurants, the music. You know, it's like Pavlov's dogs. When I hear Greek music, I literally start to salivate. It actually brings up, you know, Hellas and the International Cafe and places like that where I've eaten so many meals. But oftentimes groups that have a great solid identity are groups that are discriminated against, and that's not really true with Greeks, or is it?
It's not true now, but it used to be true. When the Greeks first arrived in Detroit, they could not live in most neighborhoods. And, in fact, the reason Greektown is located where it is right now is because it was next to the Black Bottom area, Paradise Valley. And they thought this was a good place to put Greeks as sort of a buffer zone against the African-Americans, in the same way that today sometimes Latinos are placed in these buffer zones. And Greeks had... not a negative view, but they were looked at suspiciously really up until World War II.
What brought Greeks to Detroit in the first place? Because you talk about in your book, My Detroit.
What brought the Greeks to Detroit was the same that brought a lot of other people to Detroit, is that the automobile industry. Greeks started coming into the country heavily in the 1900s, in 1905, 1906. I think 1910 may have been one of the peak years. And so that was about the time when the Ford enterprise was really getting rolling. And so people went to Detroit to be in the automobile industry. And one of the things I talk about is that Greeks in Detroit were in the automobile industry, worked in the factories, or had the diner outside the factory, or sold a newspaper outside the factory, pretty much so up until the 1940s, 1950s, when after in the 50s, then Greeks became teachers and real estate people and things of that nature. But before that, they're pretty much auto workers.
And also, is this just because of Greek time, but I heavily identify Greeks with restaurants.
Yes, this is an international trait. I think the reason Greeks are in restaurants, it's a business reason. You know, it's a labor-intensive business. So when people come from abroad and they try to start a business, starting an eating place is one of the cheaper things to do because mainly it's labor. And although we think of Greek town and we think, wow, Greeks and cooking, but there's Chinese restaurants, the Jewish deli, the Italian pizzeria, which is how they all started. And it's for the same reason. Here, it's like if you're willing to stay up 18 hours a day and keep it open 7 days a week, you can probably survive. And that's how Greeks got started. And Greek town originally was quite a modest area, and it's through the years that it got the restaurants got bigger and more elaborate.
My guest is Dan Georgiakis. He is the author of a memoir, My Detroit, Growing Up Greek and American in Motor City. It's published by Pella, P-L-L-A. We'll tell you more about it as the interview goes on, and I'll have a link to it on my site, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. I had a Greek friend when I went to elementary school, and I remember one time he said that he and his family were going to Belle Isle to pick dandelions. I said, what for? He said, because we eat them. And I thought, whoa, these people are weird.
Every Greek talks about this story because when you're a kid, you go out there to pick the dandelions and you say, oh, boy, this is free. And then you say, gee, I hope the Americans don't see us doing this because it'll seem like kind of wild and crazy. But, yeah, dandelions are a great food. Greeks call them horta. And you'll find them on all genuine menus. And every Greek family went out and cut those dandelions.
And what we should tell people, what I didn't understand at the time was that I thought that they're eating these yellow flowers, but no, it's the
green.
It's the greens, and that was at the actually in Greektown. I think the only place I remember ever getting it was at the that Gus's International Cafe, which unfortunately is no longer there. But it's like greens of any sort that are braised and very tasty.
Yes, here in the New York area, you'll find horta in almost all the restaurants. They do put them on. I didn't realize they didn't do them in Detroit. They used to put them on the menu in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, Dan Georgiakis, we've kind of lost contact with one another over the years. And as I said when I introduced you, that you're the director of the Greek American Studies Project at the Center for Byzantine and Modern Greek Studies at City University of New York. And if someone said previous to me seeing this in your memoir, My Detroit, they'd say, tell me about Dan Georgiakis. I'd say that he was an author who wrote about Indian tribes. I was just looking at the two books that you wrote, and that was years and years ago, that you wrote about radical African-American workers in revolt, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. But you said they called you the Greek, but was there a sudden, like, Saul on the road to Damascus kind of epiphany that you got, or how did this come about?
In terms of my political points of view and dealing with others, it was a real evolution, and the evolution was living in America and seeing what the society was like. And I think probably what becomes more apparent to us, to me at least, was when I was going to Southeastern High School, which is an integrated high school, the stuff I've been reading about in books about African Americans suddenly became more real. And suddenly you realize this is a very unfair society. I mean, we'd already, as Greeks or as immigrants, we'd always,
knew about the problems we had, but basically this was minor league, you know. It was just people maybe couldn't say your name and look down on you a little bit and so forth. But it was nothing major league. I lived on the Far East Side, which was all white, although I should say really wasn't all white. And what I point out in my book is that there were lots of Latinos on the East Side, and there were Asians, and my high school buddy Shams Ali, who was an Ethiopian, somehow he could live on the East Side, but if you were an African American, you couldn't live past Connor Avenue. And suddenly that just seemed to be unfair to me when I was going to high school, and in the next couple of years I just saw it as the whole racism of America went from being abstract to being very personal. I write of the fact that my grandfather was ill and in the hospital. I was with a cancer patient, and his roommate was a cancer patient. And every day he went there, his face would come more and more into the skin until finally it looked like a skull. And I began to think of racism that way. It was this cancer eating into American society, and we just had to do something about it. And that was part of being American, was doing something about it instead of accepting it.
But at some point, it appears, tell me if I'm right or wrong, that you became, like, ultra-conscious of your Greek identity.
Oh, my Greek identity was there from the beginning.
Really?
The Greek identity was always there, and the Greek identity is what fused into my American identity, as it were. That the two always, I think this is true of most people that are there, well, I'm going to say psychologically sound. I think most people are psychologically sound. You're both at the same time, and you're either, you may emphasize one or the other depending on the situation, but you feel comfortable with it all back and forth. And as they say, as I got older, what I became more conscious of was my duties as an American, my obligations as an American citizen, what were we going to do about this horrible racial situation in the city of Detroit. And one of the things I wrote about in my book is I believe in the 50s and in the 60s, we did a lot of things that were very interesting in terms of newspapers, theaters, music, literary magazines, all of which had blacks and whites working together, and the city just ignored us. They basically saw the African American population as a problem rather than as an asset. And if you were associated with the problem, then you became part of the problem too instead of being part of the solution. And I think that led to the disasters which evolved in the 70s and the 80s.
Mm-hmm. It's something you're not talking about Greek publications. You're talking about what you were mentioning.
I'm talking about a little theater on Temple called the Unstable Coffee House.
Oh, yeah, the home of, remind me of how many famous people came out of there, although I can't.
William Tomlin is one of them.
The biggest, yeah.
A Detroiter.
Yeah.
And Woody King Jr., who's since gone on and done Broadway shows. Sammy Saunders did jazz there. Benny Maupin was there. Maupin was there doing jazz. So that little theater, which existed for a number of years, spun off the Concept East, which became an all-black theater. But the city never paid much attention to us. We had a literary magazine called Serendipity. We did a musical magazine once called On the Town. And I'm just talking about things that I was personally involved in. There were all kinds of things of that nature going on in the city, and the city didn't really embrace it. It didn't really know what to do with this stuff. And I think they were afraid that if we're going to do a play at the Unstable about black issues in Detroit, that it was going to cause problems rather than it was going to get us toward a solution.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did the Greek community itself relate to movements like the civil rights movement? Most ethnic communities, or at least good portions of them, were pretty negative towards blacks demanding rights in the 1950s and 60s. Did the Greek community act any differently?
It wasn't significantly different, but it was quite, I would say, passive in some ways. But there's some peculiar history in terms of the Greeks. Greektown, for instance, was one of the only places in the city of Detroit where an African-American could get a meal in the 1940s and 1950s, and my source for that is none other than Coleman Young. And the reason for that was very peculiar. The judicial system, you know, the court system is right there a couple blocks away, and they have to feed juries. And the in the 40s, the city came to the Greektown merchant and said, well, we'd like to bring our juries here, but, you know, they're black and white, and no other restaurant would take those juries in the 1940s, and the Greektown merchants did take them. So they got used to having black customers, and so there was a bit of an easier, more familiarity with African Americans, I think, than with some other ethnic groups. We also have a very dramatic action of Archbishop Iacovus. Iacovus, when Martin Luther King marched in Selma, Iacovus went with him. And Iacovus is this very tall guy with this very regal appearance, and he ended up on the cover of Time magazine, of Life magazine. It was Martin Luther King, Iacovus, and Walter Reuther. Quite a pair, pairing or trioing. But of course, what did happen was the Archbishop, although he personally took this action, didn't do anything with the church. He didn't tell his priests, look, let's get busy on this issue. He just let it sit there. And in that sense, I think that parallels something that Walter Reuther did also. Walter Reuther walked in Selma, but he didn't do very much to integrate the UAW at the management level.
Yeah. Dandra Jack is my guest. The book is My Detroit, Growing Up Greek and American in the Motor City. I mentioned earlier Middlesex by, I can't remember if I'm saying.
Eugenides,
yeah. One of the shocking sections of this novel, which I had never heard of before, was this massacre of Greeks at Smyrna in, where is it, in Asia Minor, but that, is that in Turkey?
It's in Turkey now, Asia Minor, 1922, and it was a war. It's a little bit different than the Armenian genocide, where the Armenian genocide was really a genocide, a premeditated genocide, 1915. 1.5 million Armenians were killed. The Greek-Turkish conflict was a war. The Greeks had lost and were being routed, and the Turkish army was chasing them, and the burning of Smyrna occurred in September of 1922, and it's very personal for me because my mother was there.
Really?
My mother, in fact, was on the last boat out of the harbor. And I guess part of my radical perspective or third way of looking at things comes from her, because she informed me as a kid that when they were in the harbor there, the American boats, the British boats, the French boats, that none of those boats would pick up the survivors because they had made some kind of agreement not to do it. And the boat that took her up was a Japanese boat. And she was saved by a Japanese boat that took her to Greece. She was about 11 or 12 years old at the time. And it was funny because she was born on December 8th. And so Pearl Harbor, of course, is December 7th. And people get into a wound up about the Japs, you know, about December 7th. And she always would sort of sit there and say to me, well, you know, not all Japanese are bad.
Right, well.
It saved your life. And I think stuff like that in my growing up gave me a kind of a different way of looking at things, which wasn't to say that Pearl Harbor was a great thing or anything like that, but simply things aren't as simple as we sometimes want them to be. And as far as the Turks were concerned, my mother, as I say, fled for her life, and she talked about massacres and these horrible things. But they also, my grandfather also talked about his Turkish friends that he used to have. And I write about this in the book. My grandfather murdered a Turk, but what was it over? It was over a woman.
Huh.
That's how he killed him. And who helped? And his friends, who were Turks, said, "You got to get out of here because if you get tried, you'll be executed." And so they helped him escape. So I try and get at some of these complexities about inter-ethnic relationships.
Now does the massacre at Smyrna, is that one of those things that's emblazoned in every Greek's mind, or is that just
totally? You say 1922 to a Greek, and that's what they talk about is the burning of Smyrna. And the thing about Smyrna, which is so significant, and I don't think Eugenides got this right, or he didn't understand it very well, is the Greeks had been in Asia Minor for something like 2,500 years. And so whether they were under the Romans or whether they were under the Persians or whether they were under the Ottomans, it was still kind of a Greek, a cultural enclave. And so with 1922, the Greeks were more or less expelled from Asia Minor. In the following two or three years, they made an agreement, and 1.5 million Greeks left Asia Minor, and 500,000 Turks left Greece. And so the Greek presence in Asia Minor pretty much came to an end.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a traumatic and eventful moment. I sometimes talk with Turkish friends, and they say, you know, that was the biggest mistake we ever made, because we'd have done better to have some kind of communal arrangement. Sure, it would be a Turkish government, but it didn't have to expel all the other ethnicities.
Well, Dan Trajak, we're almost towards the end of things, and I'm thinking of like I said, like a tourist. My main connection with the Greek community is still at Greektown, and in many ways hasn't seemed to change. I mean, it's changed a lot over the decades, but we still see a lot of people who have accents, which says to me that there's a continuing Greek immigration to Detroit. Is that true?
There is a it slackened off considerably. The last big immigration was between 65 and 80. But what's happened now, more so than in the generation I grew up with, people stay closer to the homeland. In other words, they go back and forth by airplanes, and there's the internet and connections, and so therefore those who retain their ethnicity retain it a little bit stronger, and that's why you hear those accents. And also, when you come to the city like Detroit and you're looking for a job, the first place you go to is Greektown. And I must say, the man who used to call the mayor of Greektown was a cumbado of mine, or a tío of mine, an uncle, not a real uncle. And he used to play cards, you know, he used to play pinochle and behind those windows and play all day. And he was the one who arranged the marriage of my mother and father. Mr. Vlachandonis. Mike's Copy Shop, Griswold Avenue.
Well, we've got about 30 seconds left. The importance of ethnicity, is it usually groups just after a while, like the ones I've come from, just wind up to be American mongrels, as I call myself. You think it's important to maintain these ethnic identities?
That's a good question. Is it important? I have no option. I think that if you have an ethnic identity, you have no option but to keep it going. But I think it should be got going informally and through the community itself, and not through outside the manipulation of that. And if it survives and wants to survive, it will survive. And if it doesn't want to survive and it wants to just become folded into the American community, that's fine too.
Well, Danger Jack, is actually say one more time how they would greet your last name by your last name in Greece.
I would be Kostandinos Yoriakas.
Yoriakas. I love that. All right. The book is My Detroit, Growing Up Greek and American in Motor City. It's published by Pella, P-E-L-L-A. You can go to Amazon.com. Just look for My Detroit, Dan Georgiakis. It's been wonderful talking with you, and I look forward to going through the book. Thanks, Dan.
My pleasure.
Okay. WRIM.com.
another big riff winner jetting off to Maui.
Can you say, come on, I want to lay you?
Oh, my God!
You're going to Maui!
I don't believe it. I'm going to have a heart attack.
You want to have a heart attack, please? Who is this?
This is Karen.
Karen, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Romeo. Oh, my God. I can't believe this. It's like a dream.
Keep listening. Your next chance to win could come at any time. Maui Time 2007. From Budweiser and 101. The
been out your head. I hold deep in muddy waters. You're practically raised.